new year. I'd also quickly just like to welcome a new member to the team, Peter Best, our new General Manager for Infrastructure and Operations. Welcome. Today is obviously the word has got out that you're here because we have a full gallery. So welcome to Redland City Council, and we've also got Andrew Ross sitting in the role of Organisational Services at the moment, and Kim, Acting General Manager of Customer and Community Services, while there's some leave happening. So and Angela. Angela, who's sitting in for Amanda, so who's away on some sick leave. So to all of you, welcome, and I'll start as I always do by acknowledging the Quandamooka people, who are the traditional owners of the land on which we meet here this morning. I'd also like to pay respect to their elders past and present, and extend that respect to any other Indigenous Australians who may be here this morning. Seeing we have a full gallery, I will read out our standing orders in regards to public conduct at these meetings. It's under section 32, for those of you who need some bedtime reading if you want to attend meetings. But basically it stipulates that all members of the public present at a meeting must, not without the prior approval of the chairperson, make any audio or video recording or take any photographs. You must remain quiet and not disrupt the meeting in any way. Not bring into the meeting any signs, placards or items that may cause a hazard or interfere with any person present. You must be suitably dressed and turn all mobile devices to silent mode and leave the meeting to take any phone calls. Just so you understand my role here, as chairperson, it is my responsibility to warn a member of the public present at a meeting who is not complying with any of these requirements that I may, with or without such notice, require that person to leave the meeting and not return for such a period as the chairperson decides. This period may include future meetings. We have no leaves of absence, councillors, so we'll move straight over to our devotional segment and ask member of the Redlands Ministers Fellowship, Reverend Linda Hamill from the Yarding Church at Wellington Point, to lead us in our very first devotional segment for 2017. Welcome, Linda.
Good morning. The church is in the season it calls Epiphany, and it's the season between Christmas and Lent where we intentionally ask the question, who is that baby that was born at Christmas? And we explore the person of Jesus. In the readings for last week, we read Luke chapter 5, where Jesus calls Simon Peter, a fisherman, and several others to follow him and become fishers of men. But we ask the question not whether they responded rightly or wrongly, but who were they following? They believed they were following a person with divine qualities and attributes, a radical teacher and rabbi who taught that the care of widows and orphans was paramount. He encouraged radical forgiveness and offered grace. He demonstrated healing of those who had no other means. He cared for all, and he walked with people in their less than desirable circumstances, offering hope to all people and all creation. Jesus then summarized the law into the catchphrase that most of us would have heard at some point, to love God with our hearts, mind, soul, and strength, and to love our neighbor as ourselves. All of the law of the Old Testament could be summarized in those two statements, to love God and love your neighbor. We, in the Christian tradition, follow a Jesus who has authority, a natural leader that we might even say who was charismatic. But if you look at the word charis or charismatic in the original Greek language, you find that a person who had charis was a gift. They were generous. They were full of thankfulness and goodness and offered their blessings. And we as Christians believe that that's how all people should live. But were it so easy, I can't even get the people in my own family to comply with those that high of a standard. And history has proven that even the church over and over again has failed in enacting that radical forgiveness and love and grace and goodness and generosity. But we continue to study these beliefs and hold them to be true. But how, so much so that our modern society and government were built on those principles that came from the Christian faith. How troublesome it is when we begin to follow other characteristics and believe that the law is dominated by ourself, our requirements and our needs. And I recognize that is the space that council finds itself in governing, practicing good governance for all people, to encourage hope and faith and love and forgiveness and grace, and yet keep a standard by which, I don't know, the church even fails. So we do, as the ministers fraternal, pray for counsel. You're prayed for just about daily through all the churches. We pray also for our community. And this morning I open this first meeting of the year with prayer. Almighty God, unto paths we have never traveled, you call us. Towards horizons ever stretching, you call us. To dawns we have never seen, you call us. And we hear you. Go with us on our journey and shape our hopes in heaven. Help us to invest in wonder and direct our longings in each moment as we go. Onto boats we've never seen, you call us. Into waters we have never sailed, you call us. And through the nights we have never expected, you call us. And we hear you. We ask that you take our living and hold us close. Hold our needs and unfold them. Take our faith and trust what little there is, and journey with us as we go. Into a world we have broken, you called us. Into lives we have abused, you've called us. Into a history we have not learned from, you call us, and we hear you. Loving Father, take our regrets and love us. Take our hurts and heal them. Take our questions and our doubts and encourage us. Go with us on this journey. And we will go. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. And I leave you with this blessing, called to follow, called to care, called to serve. May we go from here ready to answer, called to act, called to listen, called to challenge. May we go from here ready to respond with God's blessing, with Christ's call, and with the Spirit's leading. May we go in peace to love and serve the Lord in the name of Christ. Amen.
Councillors, the next item on the agenda is recognition of achievement. And before I hand over to Councillor Mitchell, I think it's probably appropriate that we recognise that last evening we had the great pleasure of announcing who our Redlands Citizen of the Year was and a number of associated awards. And as the CEO rightly said in the ceremony, that we're always in awe of the talent and the commitment and the passion that we have right here in the city of Redlands. This year it's with great pleasure and pride that we just reiterate those people who have taken out the honours, despite the fact we know we have many people of that ilk in our city, but the Citizen of the Year for 2017 is Dennis Ryan. The Young Citizen of the Year is young Leah Lever. Senior Citizen of the Year, Cole Cunnington. Local Hero Award, Ian and Judy Wintle. A Community Organisation Award is the Redlands Centre for Women, and we had a tie with the Bayside Vehicle Restorers Club. And for those of you who are at loose end early in the morning, Councillor Boglari and I will be at Ormiston State School judging their historic vehicles and setting them off on their rally. Cultural Award, our very own town crier, Maxwell Bissett, who once again demonstrated the strength of his vocal cords as he received his certificate. The Environment and Sustainability Award, Michael Wilson, and Sports Award, no stranger to these chambers, young Daniel Fox. So please, if you know them or you see them about, please congratulate them, and we need to encourage people like that to invest their time and their commitment in this city. I'm now going to hand over to Councillor Mitchell, who's advised he also would like to recognise a young Redlander.
Thank you, Madam Mayor. And a lovely segue on Australia Day Eve to give some kudos to a great Australian activity and a great Australian, a surfer, Ethan Ewan from North Stradbroke Island, who's our newly crowned World Junior Surfing Champion. He's put Stradie and our city on the world map yet again. It's just wonderful. I'll read some of his achievements and then, more importantly, I'll get a few comments from some of his peers on the island. 18-year-old Ethan has the surfing world at his feet and the ability to follow in the footsteps of so many Aussie surf greats. He's been tagged the next big thing. This puts a lot of pressure on, but this wonderful young man has taken it all in his stride. He's been compared to other world champions, including people he has idolised enormously himself. The pressure has been enormous, but he's taken it in his stride. He's used to making waves. Ethan's recent victory in the World Surfing Junior Championship at Kiama on New South Wales South Coast came as no surprise to those he know. He's so good, they would have been stunned if he had not won. Ethan did win. To claim our first world title of 2017. People really sat up and started to take notice when he finished second as a wild card in the US Open of Surf in August 2016. His performance during 2016 earned him Rookie of the Year title and a spot on the Senior Pro Tour. The experts predict even bigger and better things from the young man who has been compared with the legendary Andy Irons, who happens to be Ethan's favourite surfer. Ex-world champion Mick Fanning says Ethan's the real deal. He's been described by other surfing sages as a hybrid of the best surfers in the world. For Point Lookout Board Riders President Chris Semple, it was only a matter of time before Ethan cracked the big time. Chris has no doubt that Ethan will follow in the footsteps of fellow Stradie board rider, Bede Durbidge, and excel on the world tour. These two boys, says Chris, making it on the pro tour gives new hope to everyone. They know that with media coverage, sponsorship and prize money, they can make surfing their career. Chris remembers Ethan as the kid who always was better than others in his age group, the kid who matched it on the wave with some of the best surfers on Stradie. The kid who knocked elder brother Curtis from his perch as the best surfer on the island. And as a man with an older brother, I know how good that must have felt. Ethan's improvement over the past 12 months is out of sight, according to the proud president of the club that has helped nurture the young champ since he was 5 years old. And this is a very close-knit surfing community over there, and they really do look after their own. They couldn't be prouder. Cracking the pro circuit is a huge achievement. We hoped and thought he could do it, and he has. He's gone to the new level over the past year, says Chris. Ethan Ewing will be a wonderful ambassador for surfing and for Stradie and Redland City. I know I speak for my colleagues, says Chris, when I wish Ethan the very best of the 2017 Championship Tour. If that wasn't enough, Ethan's also a very humble man, very polite young man, a gentleman, and a credit to his family. And where else would he be today but in Hawaii? And he does send his best wishes. Where else would he be? If we couldn't be any more slightly jealous. But anyway, well done, Ethan. Well done. Thank you.
Thank you, Councillor Mitchell. Haven't been advised of any other recognitions of achievement, so we'll move on with the agenda, and that takes us to item 5.1, general meeting minutes, and require a confirmation of that. Can I please have a mover and seconder, please, that the minutes of general meeting held on the 14th of December 2016 be confirmed? Move Councillor Golay, seconded Councillor Gleeson. Any items of correctness, councillors? There being none, I put the motion. Those in favour? Those against? The motion is carried unanimously, and Councillor Elliott is absent. Next item on the agenda is item 6, matters outstanding, and I don't believe there are any for the CEO to report this morning, so we'll go straight to public participation. Now, look, just before we do that, I have been advised by a few people who'd like to address council this morning, but I might just check if there are other people who haven't yet put forward their name so that we can allocate an appropriate amount of time. So far I have 5 people. Gail Nemeth, Albie Sutton, we have John Derbyshire, and we also have Alb Carton and Bill Giles. Are they all here? Can't see who's in the corner there. That's Gail. 1, 2, 3, 4. I can't see Bill. Oh, he withdrew? Okay, you did. Okay. So my apologies. Bill has withdrawn. So that leaves us with 4. Are there any other people that would like to address council this morning? Mr. Wood, is it a similar issue? Because I believe there is a matter that's been dealt with in the court, and I probably would rather say that for the other speakers who haven't yet addressed council on their issues.
It's to do with what went on and subsequently what needs to be done to fix it.
Well, I think in this instance you have it actually addressed and it's been dealt with the court. We'll just see how we go for time, if that's okay, Mr. Wood. Now, any other people that would like to address council? All right, so that's not too bad. So with that in mind, we allow about a five-minute presentation. So, councillors, what I'm going to ask is if we could actually have a mover and seconder the meeting adjourn for, say, a 20-minute public participation segment to allow members to address council. Moved, Councillor Bishop, seconded Councillor Edwards. Those in favour? Those against? The motion is carried unanimously. Councillor Elliott is absent. Okay, so just before we call you up to the microphone, just a reminder of how proceedings occur with public participation. You may have noticed that there is signage in chambers regarding public participation at meetings. It is Council's usual practice to require any person wishing to address the meeting to state their name and suburb or organisation that they represent and the subject that they wish to speak about. This information is recorded in the minutes of the meeting, which is a public document available for inspection at Council's administration building and published on Council's website. I also need to advise you that this meeting is being recorded in audio video, and that by speaking you acknowledge and agree that the video recording may be placed in the public domain. Any person addressing a meeting will state their name and suburb or organisation they represent and the subject they wish to speak about. They will stand unless they are unable to do so. Please act and speak with decorum. Be respectful and courteous. Make no comments directed at any individual council employee, councillor or member of the public, ensuring that all comments relate to council as a whole. Another outline of my responsibility as chairperson, I will consider each application on its merits and consider any relevant matter in making my decision to allow or disallow a person to address the local government. I'll give priority to the members of the public who have made written application to the CEO to address the meeting, and I'll determine the maximum number of speakers based on the number of persons wanting to speak and the time available. Each speaker has a maximum of 5 minutes, dependent on the number of speakers. It's also my responsibility to withdraw the approval to address council before the time period has elapsed. Debate or discussion, it's very important, can't be entered into at this time. Now, if there's anyone that's requiring a hearing loop, if you just raise your hand and we'll bring that microphone to you, but I would ask you to stand while you're speaking. All right, so our first speaker this morning is Gail Nemeth of Macleay Island. Gail, would you like to come up to the microphone? I think you know the drill. Name, suburb or organisation you represent. You can start when you're ready, Gail.
Thank you, Mayor. Before I proceed, Mayor, my colleague Lindsay Hackett, a friend, was also going to present here this morning. Unfortunately, he's been called to the surgeons. And it was hoped, and I understand Lindsay has had some contact with your office, and it was hoped that we could have a little latitude for that I may present also what he was going to say.
Well, can we start, and we'll just measure that time and see how we go. Gail, is that I'm sure that will be that should be okay, but we have got a lot of speakers this morning.
Appreciate that. I'd like to begin by wishing the council all the best for 2017. Madam Mayor, councillors, CEO, members of the public, I stand here today on behalf of Lindsay Hackett, who has asked me to speak. I do so on his behalf, and for the many islanders who have given Lindsay and me authority to speak on their behalf, and for myself. The Moreton Bay Combined Island Association, MBCIA, has delivered a flyer to properties on Macleay Island and probably all islands. The flyer highlights several matters the MBCIA believe are of interest to islanders and raises again the matter of a bridge between Russell Island and the mainland. The continuing fixation of MBCIA with this bridge is divisive within the islander community. Most islanders understand the gist of what I'm about to say, but there is confusion because the messages put out by the MBCIA, the messages are one-sided. The MBCIA has never produced a study, an analysis to show how the bridge will benefit all the islands. Overall, or can be made financially viable, economically sound or acceptable to all governmental agencies that must be involved. Lindsay Hackett and I have been closely involved with the community, council and state government for many years in consideration and activities concerning transport for islanders. Recent arrivals to the islanders and some councillors may not be aware that this matter has been raised regularly. Since 1980s, it is an old perennial. In 1986, the Queensland Government requested tenders to construct a bridge to Russell Island. 11 responses were received initially. The Government finally declared that none of the responses were commercially viable. Since then, Council and State Governments have argued consistently that a bridge is not considered viable infrastructure, from either a State Government or private enterprise perspective. In 2010, in order to investigate the possibility of alternate transport routes between the islands and the mainland, Redland City Council commissioned consultants GHD to do an independent study of alternate access routes to the islands, including alternate barge, water taxi, and a bridge to Russell Island from the mainland. This study considered 6 different options for a bridge. The report of the study is entitled Southern Moreton Bay Island Water Transport Alternative Route Study, dated February 2011. This report shows that the cheapest bridge, a bridge costing $114 million, requires annual revenue of about $8.5 million to break even at a government funding rate of return. Much greater revenue would be needed at a commercial rate of return. The report notes that environmental and other impacts of the bridge would be significant, but were not studied. Also not costed were the necessary improvements to the connecting road, infrastructure on Russell Island and the mainland, other than the immediate approaches to the bridge. The report states that the cheapest bridge would require 6.25 million trips annually to reach break-even after 25 years. That is to pay off the infrastructure costs. This equates to 17,000 trips per day based on the adopted trip value or cost of $1.30. Simple proportioning shows this is equivalent to about 800,000 crossings of the bridge per year one way at a toll of $10, a figure that has been suggested by the bridge lobby in the past. This equates to more than 2,000 crossings a day at that $10 per crossing cost. A bridge is not financially viable based on these figures. The GHD report further states that the maximum capacity of the present barge service at that time was 84,000 vehicle trips per year, far less than the 800,000 trips needed to fund the bridge at $10 per crossing. Given that the bridge would remove about 40% of vehicles from the barge service, the proportion of Russell Islanders using the barge service, the cost impact on other islanders using the remaining barge service would likely be significant. Interestingly, Russell Islanders using the bridge would arrive on the mainland in the middle of nowhere, Little Rocky Point, north of Woongoobla. The nearest major shopping centre, Beenleigh, 17 kilometres away, over poorly formed back roads. Compare this distance with the travelling from Weenham Creek to Victoria Point, 5 kilometres, and to Cleveland, 12 kilometres. Both of these accessible by public transport, as well as by car. The time and energy spent by council and islanders and the islander community, indeed I say wasted, on the continuing and impractical hope of a bridge between Russell Island and the mainland should stop, unless, until circumstances change to unequivocally show the overriding need for a bridge and the bridge concept, the council is respectfully asked to make an executive decision that this bridge concept not be considered or encouraged further until that time. Council has been pressed for many years by groups wanting a bridge to Russell Island from the mainland. There are potentially serious consequences from this continual push. Councillors will know that a bridge is contrary to accepted government council policies that islanders are to be serviced by water-based transport. A bridge is at odds also with the interest of most islanders who want the islands to remain islands, not joined to the mainland so as to become just another suburb accessible to all and sundry. The islands are a special, unique place of peace and tranquility within the waters of Ramsar waters of Moreton Bay. The relative isolation of these islands is essential to their character. Surely people coming to the island should understand this and choose a different abode if they truly want all suburban conveniences. The Weenham Creek PDA development is in accord with the accepted water-based transport policy, and the important inclusion of the car parking element for islanders is a result of strong community campaigning over several years. Providing this parking will complete a satisfactory water-based system for the Bay Islands, now and into the future. Importantly, the PDA development will create a significant gateway to and a transport hub for all the islands, not just one island. It will enhance the appeal of the islands to residents and visitors alike. When and if the bridge lobby can present a substantive argument that shows how a bridge to Russell Island is a superior transport solution for all southern Moreton Bay islands, compared with the present water-based system, and that it is financially feasible, economically sound, politically acceptable, and will not destroy the character of the islands, then the majority of islanders may be interested. To date, the bridge lobby and the concept fails that criteria. Notwithstanding all of these arguments, the bridge lobby has requested to take no... arguments the bridge lobby has refused to take no for an answer. So eventually, to relieve the pressure, councillors did what councillors tend to do. They acted.
Excuse me, Gail, can I just ask how much more you've got to present there?
Mayor, maybe 2 minutes.
All right, well, two more. If you could just try to wrap up in two, that'd be great.
I'll go as quickly as I can.
Thank you.
A page and a half, ma'am. They acted politically to avoid issues without committing to any real action. Redland City Council voted on the 20th of August 2014 to ask the state government to include future consideration for a bridge between the mainland and Russell Island, to request the state government to consult with Southern Moreton Bay Island community to ensure all alternate transport proposals are reflective of the community needs, to acknowledge that the approval, funding and construction of any mainland to island bridge is a state government responsibility. The last dot point shows clearly that council has washed its hands of the matter and placed the onus on the state government. Unfortunately, council's decision has kept the bridge lobby alive and islanders alienated. It gives authorities the opportunity to do nothing substantive because they can claim islanders are divided and no action need be taken until islanders agree on a common goal. The activities of the bridge lobby are likely to delay all manner of improvements to the water-based transport infrastructure. Stradbroke ferries, the vehicular barge, and Bay Island Transit, the passenger ferries, both part of the SeaLink group, are unlikely to make investment decisions to improve services while the bridge lobby creates uncertainty about the continued operation of water-based transport. The issue with the present transport services, some raised in the MBCI flyer, would normally be resolved by market forces, as regulated by council and state government. Additional services and improved barges and ferries would normally eventuate as the economic case is made. These improvements could include a roll-on vehicular barge to carry vehicles at cheaper prices and larger, perhaps multi-deck ferries that would continue to operate along existing routes and have no further environmental impact. Councillors and islanders will recognise the misleading propaganda put out by proponents of the bridge to Russell Island, particularly the implied need for a bridge to facilitate a mass evacuation of Russell Island. Bushfires might be considered the most serious danger to Russell Island, indeed all islands, but would never require a mass evacuation. The recent bushfires on Russell Island support this conclusion.
Members of the gallery, please. I'll remind you the standing orders. People in the public gallery, you be quiet and respectful while people have the microphone. Thank you. You'll be offered the same respect. My apologies, go.
They were reported as the biggest fires in recent memory, with no houses or lives lost. Irresponsible scaremongering should not be used to support the argument for a bridge. Finally, a word about the idea of shorter barge routes. Shorter barge routes make sense if they are cheaper and can be achieved within the environmental, governmental and other constraints that exist. Lindsay Hackett's investigation of barge routes within Australia, reported to several forums over many years, show there is no correlation between shorter barge routes and cheaper prices. The site-specific costs of infrastructure, barges, staffing, loading rates, insurances, construction, environmental studies and government charges destroy any correlation. One example is the barge route between Inskip Point and Fraser Island, a distance of only 1.4 kilometres, costing $120. Compare this to the fare from Russell Island to Weenham Creek, a distance of 12 kilometres, at $99. The GHD report in section 3.4.3 at page 11 confirms the lack of correlation. The continuing studies, discussion and moving of goalposts about transport options of resources and efforts, they are causing angst and distortion of people's lives. For years, properties have been marketed on Russell Island with the anticipation of a bridge. It is still happening. At least one Russell Islander sold a home in the north of the island to buy a house close to where she was told the bridge would be built. That was 4 years ago. That council is continuing to allow this to happen is shameful. About 10 seconds, Mayor. We ask council to consult with the state government and to declare once and for all a definitive plan regarding transport between the islands and the mainland. This statement should describe the type of transport envisaged and whether it will include a bridge. The statement should cover the short term, the medium term, and the foreseeable long term. Particularly, Council is requested to make an unambiguous statement about whether or not a bridge between Russell Island and the mainland is practicable within the short term. Only then can islanders move forward with common purpose. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Nemeth. Our next speaker is Mr. Albert Sutton of Russell Island. If you'd like to come forward. As you're approaching, Albie, if I could just ask councillors if I could have a motion to extend that public participation by 10 minutes. Move Councillor Bishop, seconded Councillor Gleeson. Those in favour? Those against? The motion is carried. Mr. Sutton, if you could just start by stating your name or the organisation that you represent, and you may start.
Madam Mayor, councillors and members of the public, my name is Albie Sutton, and I've been a landowning resident of Russell Island for more than 10 years, and I'm a member of the Moreton Bay Combined Islands Association. You'll be pleased to note that I don't intend to talk about a bridge. I do intend to talk about neglect of all the islands, and that will be apparent very quickly. After retiring from a 35-year federal public service career, embracing administrative appointments at senior levels in 13 different departments, two overseas postings and a two-year period as a private secretary to then Prime Minister Bob Hawke on his personal staff, I made a rational decision to move to the island because I loved the beauty of the place and thought I could see tremendous potential for development. Sadly, my forethoughts have proven to be misplaced, and I'm now a very concerned resident. The island, located only about 50 kilometres from the Brisbane CBD, is a beautiful place to live in, but in order to enjoy its natural beauty, we residents are forced to live quite a deprived existence. We residents have to suffer. Unsealed, dusty roads which need regular repair at great cumulative cost, and repairs that are carried out are piecemeal and at best temporary. The recent move towards polymer sealing, while appreciated, lacks considered planning and is no more than another stopgap measure. Poor street drainage and privately built sewerage systems that leach human waste effluent into the waters of our beautiful bay, a situation that will have disastrous long-term environmental impact. Bad street signage and inadequate street lighting. Abysmal parking provision at ferry terminals on both the island and at Redland Bay. High cost of purchasing items unavailable for sale on the island. This high cost factor extends to larger builder materials and associated infrastructure needs. High transport costs, which isolate families from their close relatives. This isolation often leads to loneliness, depression, and even suicide. And last but not least, council neglect of unoccupied properties throughout the island. And for these and other deprivations not listed here, we pay rates totally disproportionate to their return and material benefits. There seems to be a reluctance, either contrived or perhaps conspired, for reasons only known to the apparent conspirators, to suppress development in this place. And this reluctance seems to be shared by the three arms of government under which we live. Whenever we residents complain, we are either treated with disdain or are told that we chose to live here and therefore must accept the deficiencies that exist. This is an unacceptable argument and rings of governing bodies' attitudes of ignorance, self-interest, or incapability to cope with the requirements of their elected governance. In choosing to live somewhere, you don't surrender your right to protect your entitlements as a resident or landowner.
Yeah, yeah.
Each resident is a shareholder in Southern Moreton Bay Island's development. Governing bodies, support staff and elected representatives must better recognise that they are in the employ of we, their electors, and must act with more considered integrity in making decisions that affect our welfare and lifestyles. We're not puppets to be manipulated, ignored by exclusion from participation in decision-making debate, and then used as vehicles for the self-benefit of our elected representatives. We landowners have had our island holdings devalued by often more than $30,000 in recent years, and we've had enough of being cheated and maligned and treated as virtual third world citizens. And another 30 or 40 years of suppression is not acceptable. The recent fires on both Mackay and Russell Island graphically demonstrated the cost of these governance failings. And the cost could have been much higher in both personal and economic terms. Had the Russell Island fire started 3 days later, on the Sunday, when the southeasterly wind was raging at near gale force levels, there could well have been a disaster of monumental national proportions, contributed to in no small way by the overgrown state of vacant land on the island. Surely, the impact of the fires and the deficiencies of infrastructure and prescribed emergency action they exposed must penetrate the minds of all the governing bodies, and hopefully it will result in a greatly increased and immediate interest in quickly beginning to correct the years of neglect and perceived disinterest that has occurred. Against this background, I would like to ask each of you here in Council to reflect on your own capacities to make appropriate judgments on future decisions you make, and when making such judgments, ensure that you have a complete understanding of all considerations and effects of such judgments before putting them into practice. The practice of the Redland City Council in adhering to a culture of secrecy, the lack of adequate scrutiny enabled by comprehensive community and stakeholder consultation, has now put property and people's very lives at risk. In my professional opinion, based on 35 years' experience, culminating in senior levels in the departments of Prime Minister and Cabinet, and as a private secretary to Bob Hawke, then Prime Minister of Australia, I submit to every councillor here that this council and the previous Redland City Council, by its negligence, has committed and continues to commit a significant duty of care breach. Note that I do not merely allege a duty of care breach. I challenge, on the basis of my 35 years of senior and extensive and international parliamentary experience, that this negligence suggests that a duty of care breach exists on both public safety and administrative grounds. I advise, in closing, that this statement has been copied to relevant authorities for the appropriate action, with the endorsement of SIMBI Forum stakeholders and other SIMBI community leaders, and authority references relevant, and a written, more informative submission will follow. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Sutton. Being that that's the last speaker we have on that topic, what I might do just quickly is, just for the public record, I'll ask Mike, if you wouldn't mind, just in regards to a couple of items community consultation on the disaster management plan that occurred, and also in light of what's happened, what council has already enacted in the review with QFES, if you don't mind, Mike. I'm sorry to put you on the spot, and I'll just stop the clock for that moment till we come back to public participation, just to make sure the record is correct. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Mayor. Councillors, executive members, and particularly the members of the gallery who have demonstrated some real passion in being here today to put their point forward, and it's very much appreciated, I think, by everybody in this room. One of the processes that we did put together in the formation of our disaster management plan was a comprehensive consultation across the islands and across the mainland. It's not lost on me in sitting here now that a lot of people aren't aware of that process and are actually suggesting that the plan was put together without due consultation. And that's something I'll take personal responsibility for and attempt to rectify with members of the island. I attended the island with many of the people who are here today on Sunday to speak about our planning processes and the things we have in place, and I stand by and make very publicly and to you, councillors, a commitment that we will rectify the consultation processes on the island. And already I'm in discussions with Queensland Fire and Emergency Services, Queensland Police, in ourselves, in developing a very comprehensive process of consultation on the island to ensure that members of the community there will be able to be better prepared and have a better idea of what the planning process should be. I should also make you aware that as late as this week, we have engaged or formalised the engagement of Queensland Fire and Emergency Services corporate arm, known as Training and Emergency Management, to carry out a full and independent review of Council's mitigation processes across the entire area. It's fair to say that the things that they may come up with may conflict with the things we are doing. They may support what we're doing. They may conflict with what people on the island are telling us. They may support that. But the one promise you will have, and we've invited the chair of the Moreton Bay Combined Islands Association to be part of the governance panel on that group, we can assure you that will be a full, frank and independent review of the processes. And the final thing I'd like to say, Madam Mayor, is that we have engaged the Office of the Inspector General and the Office of Queensland Reconstruction Authority to carry out a comprehensive review of the planning processes, the preparedness, the response and the recovery phases of the disaster management processes across Russell Island as a measure of dealing with isolated communities right throughout Queensland. So I think it's important that the people of Russell Island know that they are being heard and that the processes we will put in place are going to be short-term processes aimed at looking for some real rectification to any concerns they may have. Thank you, Mayor.
Thank you, Mike. My next speaker is Mr. Alb Carlton. I'm not sure that's spelled right in my list, that's all. If you'd like to come forward and if you wouldn't mind stating your name and suburb or the organisation you represent. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Mayor. Councillors, thanks for the opportunity to speak today. My name is Orb Carlton. I'm the chairman of the Villa Edgewater Body Corporation that is based at 6 Harbourview Crescent. And I'd like to speak towards the proposed mixed development at 4 Harbourview Court and 144A Cleveland Street. My piece will be very short because I'm being followed, I believe, by John, who will probably give you a lot more detail than I will. But there's three areas of concern, and I have read through the report you have in front of you today. The three areas of real concern to our community down there is the fact that this 29-metre, nine-storey imposing building will look into a percentage of our residents' private courtyards, which is something they haven't experienced before, and over 50% of our private pool and barbecue facility. This will could result in a substantial cost to our community in trying to impose some type of screening or some type of way of imposing it or giving us back the privacy that we currently don't have. So that's one area that really concerns our residents. And I must add, we are certainly not against development in the Redlands area. It's just good development we would like to be able to support. The other area is shown in the report is the removal of a significant tree in this proposal. It is the Sydney eucalyptus pine, which is based at the front, which is to be removed and be replaced by a coffee shop facility. This tree is a significant tree, and you can see the pictures of that tree in your report is shown. It is every evening visited by a mass of lorikeets and is a very important part of what we believe our environment is. Apart from this, in the report it says it's sound and healthy. It may in the future cause some concern to some services or infrastructure, but that would have to be said about any tree in the council area which is alongside a footpath that's around. It also, with this development, there will be the removal of all trees on the development's northern boundary and our southern boundary, and this will be replaced in some positions by a 4-metre concrete wall where our private courtyards look out onto. So the tree environment will be removed and it will be replaced by a 4-metre concrete wall. The last area, which I'm sure John will talk about in a little bit more depth, is the parking issues. And although this building does show a code accessible response when reading through the officer's reply to the development, where we have one car park per resident in this proposal. Currently at Villa Edgewater we have 74 units. Each of those units has 2 to 3 car parks available in its own property and 13 visitor car parks. Believe me, at times our car parking is stretched quite considerably. This is probably more a matter of your master plan, and we believe that putting one car park in there is going to encroach into available commuter parking quite considerably. Thank you, Madam Mayor, for the time to speak to you.
Our next speaker is Mr. John Derbyshire. I'd like to approach the microphone, John, and I think you also know the drill. State your name or the and suburb or the organisation you represent. Thank you.
Yeah, my name is John Derbyshire. I live in Cleveland, and I'm just representing myself and hopefully the community. Madam Mayor and Councillors, thank you for providing me the opportunity to talk on the application at the Cleveland Station. I anticipate my talk will take a little bit longer than 5 minutes, not much longer, So I'd request that I be given a 5-minute extension. I know it won't take long.
If you just proceed at this point, and we'll, I've given that grace to someone else, so I'll forward you the same.
Thank you, Madam Mayor. By way of background, I've had a particular interest in town centre design, transport planning and design, as well as transit-oriented development, and I've worked professionally in these areas and have read widely on the subject. The decisions that you as a council will make in this term on planning and development of the Cleveland and Capalaba centres will be critical for businesses and the lifestyles of future generations in the Redlands. If you get the major decisions wrong, in my opinion, there's the potential for creation of a dysfunctional community. I've already submitted to all councillors a report and the reasons why, in my opinion, the development application should be refused. I had very little time to put that document together, so what I want to do is focus on a couple of key issues that may not have been stressed as much in those documents as they probably should. This project probably started with the right intentions, but it has gone completely off the rails in its implementation. It is actually a case study in how the overarching objective of a project can be lost through the implementation process. I believe the State Government Department fails to recognise this, the problem with this project, that it's gone off the rails, and his department has no intention of correcting the situation. Just an aside, there's a lot of different views and misunderstandings about what transit-oriented development, or TOD, really is. This applies to community generally and people within the planning professions, including my profession, which is engineering. If the Cleveland Town Centre has any chance of developing into a TOD, two very important TOD principles need to be applied. The first TOD principle is that the right use must be in the right location. The second principle is that there must be a focus on the transit station, in our case, the railway station. A centre cannot develop into a TOD if these two principles are not rigorously adhered to. Firstly, in the planning of the centre, and then, just as importantly, in its development, in the implementation of the plans. It requires a strong planning scheme and rigour in the development assessment. If inappropriate uses are permitted near the station, you can say goodbye to a functioning TOD. Densification in the vicinity of the railway station precinct is essential, but it has to be the right uses in the right locations. In effect, the proposed development is a large residential-only development. To regard as a mixed use is really gilding the lily. There are many reasons why residential only is an inappropriate use in that location, and this view is supported by the Cleveland Centre Master Plan, which shows no residential but commercial at that location. There's plenty of land available in the Cleveland Centre for residential. So developers can buy that up and build residential. The railway precinct is the only undeveloped state government land in the centre. The site should be set aside for uses such as government, commercial, or education and training. And by the way, I believe if those uses were there, it would largely solve a lot of the problems at Edgewater. That's the development that Orb was just talking about. The precinct should also have additional commuter parking to cater for the growth in the station catchment. Additional parking can readily be provided on the site without adversely affecting building aesthetics. It's often put up as a reason for not providing parking at a town centre. It can be readily achieved. Development of the northern part of the railway precinct, that's where this development is essentially happening, the residential component, should have regard to the southern part, that's that land between Shaw Street West and the railway line. The right development along Shaw Street West frontage is highly desirable and should be encouraged in the interests of developing a tide. It should be multi-storey with active street frontage at the ground floor level. To achieve this outcome, and the only way to achieve this outcome, is by having parking that's currently on this footprint and the required future parking located in the northern area, that is where the residential area is. What is needed and what should have been done before this project proceeded was having a more detailed master plan for the railway precinct that identifies the appropriate forms of development, the types of uses in the various parts of the precinct, and how this development may be staged, how the whole precinct development may be staged. It is agreed that parking for rail commuters, as shown in the application, is exempt from assessment by the council. However, planning for commuter parking in the Cleveland Centre is not exempt. The state government has never properly planned parking for rail commuters, and you've only got to go to any railway station in southeast Queensland and see the evidence of that. The outcome has always been that the community, nearby businesses, and the councils of the area suffer the consequences. It therefore becomes council's responsibility to undertake the planning for park and ride commuters. The council is the planning authority and has the right and responsibility to undertake that planning. Now, it's understood that the State Department proposes not to provide any more parking in principal activity centres, of which Cleveland is one. Now, this assumes that commuters will catch a bus, cycle, or walk to the train station. Such a policy may be, and in my view, is appropriate within 10 kilometres of the CBD. However, the result of such a policy in a location such as Cleveland is that commuters will drive instead, adding to the arterial road congestion. But they won't add to the congestion of the road between where they live and the railway station, because there'll never be a congestion problem of any consequence in that regard. The outcome, therefore, becomes the opposite of the overall transport objective, which is to encourage people onto public transport. Now, on the matter of parking, it's interesting to read the state government's current regional transport plan, which is called Connecting SEQ 2031. It recognises the risk in constraining parking in centres too quickly. Now, that document says, and I quote, "While growth in car parking needs to be restrained, policies that too quickly reduce the supply of car parking and increase its cost could strangle the growth of these centres." I'll just repeat that. "While growth in car parking needs to be restrained, policies that too quickly reduce the supply of car parking and increase its cost could strangle the growth of these centres." And I ask you to bear that in mind in your considerations of it, on car parking issues throughout this local government area. These comments apply to both commuter parking and parking regulated by the parking schemes. The parking rates in this council's planning scheme are currently, in my opinion, far too low, and they are not evidence-based. The state government's TOD guideline has even lower rates. They are too broad for general application. They are not evidence-based. They should not be implemented too quickly, and they are inappropriate for a centre such as Cleveland.
I should just how much further have you got? Because I think I've given you grace plus.
I've got about 2 or 3 minutes. Probably 2 minutes.
Okay, it'd be great if we didn't too.
One page to go.
Thank you.
Of 5 pages. It is relevant that the conditions of the application of council's incentive package are not met by this development. If the planning rates are applied to the development, 167, not 162 on the report, spaces are required for occupants and visitors, yet only 124 are proposed. In my opinion, the 167 is even less than the anticipated requirement. This project is ill-conceived, potentially leaving a terrible legacy for the future. However, the council has an opportunity to correct this by refusing the application. In my opinion, there is no other development approval options that could provide, that's options with conditions, no other development approval options that will provide opportunities to correct the significant issues in this application, not the least of which it is for the wrong uses. If there's an appeal to the P&E court, I believe council will win if it refused the application. I've been involved with a number of P&E court cases personally, as an expert witness, admittedly, and I believe you've got strong grounds for refusal, very strong. If the application is refused, council can then, in consultation with the state government and the community, prepare a more detailed master plan for the development of the whole of the railway precinct. I would like to conclude with a couple of comments. It is evident that the council cannot rely on the state government departments to solve the conundrum. The council has been left to pick up the pieces. A properly functioning TOD requires the right use in the right location, or the right uses in the right locations. Council should rigorously apply this principle to all planning and development assessment actions in its centres, and the application should therefore be refused. Thank you. Madam Mayor, I do have copies of largely what I've said, which I'm happy if you wish to have distributed amongst the councillors and staff.
I think you also sent out information as well.
It's somewhat different. This is really basically the words that I've just...
If you just leave it with David there and I'll organise that. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, we are out of time for our public participation, and I don't believe we've had any further speakers. If that's so, I'll ask that we move back into our normal meeting proceedings, if I may. Councillor Bishop's moved that. Councillor Tolte has seconded. Those in favour? Those against? The motion is carried unanimously. Thank you, councillors. Councillors, the next item on the agenda is presentations. And as you're aware, I have a presentation which I'll read through. Firstly, if I could, on behalf of myself and the officers who attended, thank you for allowing us to further investigate the opportunities for ecotourism. Thank you for the opportunity to be able to further investigate opportunities for ecotourism here in Redlands. As you would know, that forms part of our tourism strategy, which we adopted unanimously. And clearly we have some challenges as we approach another island in our city who will be transitioning out of one economy and into another. So on the 21st to the 23rd of November, as you'd be aware, I attended the Global Eco Asia Pacific Tourism Conference in Hobart, Tasmania. I was also pleased to see that we had our state member for Kapalabar who attended, along with some other representatives from Queensland Government. And it's obviously the premier event for Ecotourism Australia. It's been held annually for 24 years and attracts the best ecotourism operators and tourism professionals. They include leading speakers on ecotourism, sustainability and responsible tourism, as well as tourism operators, protected area managers, tourism organisations, Indigenous bodies and a number of researchers. Just quickly, what was covered at that ecotourism conference was business of best practice ecotourism, tourism in protected areas, supporting ecotourism in marine reserves, investment, community and social licence, ecotourism contributing to private conservation, which actually happens here in southeast Queensland, innovation and ecotourism futures, certification and quality standards, geotourism, ecotourism planning and development, and great walking destinations and eco lodge. The objectives of the conference are as follows. Tourism's obviously been identified, as I said, by council in our economic development strategy as one of the eight key areas of economic growth for Redlands. And ecotourism is also one of the fastest growing areas of tourism in Australia. As Redlands is a city of islands, that provides us with challenges, many of we've heard this morning, but it also provides us with opportunities. And the City of Islands has a 20,000 plus year old rich Quandamooka culture also to add to that, which they and we are keen to share. Redlands has a real opportunity to become an ecotourism destination nationally and internationally, like no other place in southeast Queensland. But what we need to do to achieve that is know what's happening not only locally, regionally, across the state, nationally, but also internationally, what the trends are, and what do the people actually want, what are the costs, who are the experts, what are the issues, how have other cities managed to push this agenda forward. States and even nations have what they're doing going about developing ecotourism, and what are the mistakes that have been encountered along the way that we can possibly avoid. Participating in the conference and the plenary sessions were attended by national, international speakers and delegates. So I've come back with a host of information, and I have some brochures here which I'm happy for you to look through, councillors. I'll put it on in our councillors' lounge. The speakers were all experts in their field, and the delegates through networking also provided us some great opportunities and some insight which would be normally fairly difficult to find right here in Redlands, if not impossible. The contacts made will prove valuable for the city, from those who delivered the successful new Three Capes track in Tasmania. The conference was kicked off by the former Virgin CEO, Brett Godfrey, who, by the way, actually lives in Brisbane, but has been working very diligently in Tasmania. He is now the ecotourism leader in walking trails. To Vince Coulthard, he's the CEO of Undjamuntana Traditional Land Associations and Association, who runs the Wilpena Pound Resort within the Ikara Flinders Ranges National Park. And they do things such as train Indigenous chefs, tour guides, resort managers, and also offer deep cultural experiences for their visitors. Of course, we're all aware of the relationship we have with Quandamooka, and of course that's part of our cultural tourism strategy for the Redlands. So these contacts that were made over there are not only important for us as a council, but ultimately for Kayak. My understanding is that the CEO of Kayak did intend to attend this conference, but was unable to at the last minute. Ecotourism has been adopted and identified as a market for the Redlands to focus on our Redlands City Tourism Strategy and Action Plan 2015-2020. This is increasingly important, as I said, given the state government's decision to end sand mining on North Stradbroke Island by 2019, and we certainly need to do what we can to empower our community and those people who could potentially invest in this industry to understand what those impacts are and what our opportunities are. North Stradbroke Island is also named in the Queensland Government's Ecotourism Plan 2016-2020 and Advancing Tourism 2016-2020, Growing Queensland Jobs strategic documents. Just in case you think that this wasn't aligned with the business of council, let me make it very clear this absolutely lines up with council's corporate plan 2015 and to 2020. I'll refer you to outcome 4.4, where councils work with the Quandamooka traditional owners to help them achieve their goal of establishing North Stradbroke Island, known also as Manjeribah, as a global eco-cultural tourism destination. Outcome 6.1, Council supports infrastructure that encourages business and tourism growth. Outcome 6.3, Council's involvement in the State Government's North Stradbroke Island Economic Transition Committee supports and aligns with Council's strategic objectives, which help deliver long-term economic sustainability for North Stradbroke Island. Some of the key messages that I took away from this conference is that ecotourism is no longer a niche business in Tasmania. It's absolutely a cornerstone. There is a growing market for ecotourism, particularly in our age group, councillors. People want to experience nature and will travel halfway around the world to actually have that experience. Australia needs a bigger share of the ecotourism market. The Asian market already comes to Australia for fresh air and blue sky. They come to Sydney mainly, so we need to do what we can to get them to other places. Australia ranks number one in the world for appeal of natural beauty, but does not make the top 10 adventure destinations. New Zealand is number three. Adventure travel is the fastest growing tourism area and provides the greatest spend. Ecotourism development develops environmental awareness. If people don't experience it, they can't love it. If they don't love it, they don't want to protect it. National parks are the cornerstone of ecotourism, and in Tasmania and other states, they include environmentally sensitive accommodation. Walking tracks and guided tours are extremely popular. Optimum length should be around 4 days and 3 nights. A walking track should include breathtaking views, some of which we have particularly on our islands, and it's very important to include Aboriginal culture. People are looking for wilderness, but not for wildness, but not necessarily wilderness. They want a touch of luxury in their accommodation. I think it's really important. One of the other takeaway messages that came from the Three Capes walk and National Park was that the state and federal government invested $24 million in that particular piece of infrastructure. Local government didn't invest any money in that at all. It was faced with a great deal of, resistance from those typical splinter groups who didn't want anyone to experience that natural environment. And if I compare that $24 million for one track in Tasmania to what funds are available to us for studies only on North Stradbroke Island, it tells you some of the challenges that we have collaboratively with the island community to make North Stradbroke viable. The conference outcomes, a report on the conference was provided in late 2016 to the Redlands Tourism Subcommittee, which was formed as a result of the tourism strategy, and they provided information on the ecotourism opportunities as identified at that summit, with a focus on actually establishing one significant walking trail on each of the islands and mainlands. So that was a challenge put together to that subcommittee to have a think about where we could potentially duplicate or imitate some of these opportunities we saw in Tasmania. Identification of the best trail routes for improvement and promotion is already underway in conjunction with this subcommittee. Post-conference contact has been made with the following people, with meetings being set. Brad Godfrey, as I mentioned before, who actually lives, I think, at Kangaroo Point, if I'm correct. Former CEO of Virgin Airlines, who now heads up the Tasmanian Walking Company. Ben O'Hara, he's the General Manager at Land Environment, the Gainsdale Group, which includes Hidden Vale, the UQ Wildlife Facility, which is one of those private conservation opportunities. Tamara O'Shea, Queensland Director General, Department of National Parks. Vince Coulthard, CEO of the Undia Munthana Traditional Land Association. We are going to organise an introduction to kayak. Just to give an outline of the presentations that were attended. There was a Welcome to Country, Ya Pulingana, by Alison Overeem, a Palawa woman, a descendant of Fanny Cochran Smith. Tony Charters is well known in tourism circles in Australia. He was a conference convener and I think made a life member at that event. He stated that ecotourism accounts for 25% of the tourism industry economy in Australia. Daniel Lee Song is the chair of the Tourism Industry Council Tasmania. Tourism has come out as the most important area of the economy for Tasmania. National parks are an important part of that. The national parks of Bay of Fires, etc., are some of the biggest attractions for Tasmania's east coast. Will Hodgman, the Premier of Tasmania, presented. Minister for Tourism, Hospitality and Events, Minister for Sport and Recreation and Minister for Aboriginal Affairs. He basically stated that no longer is Tasmania waiting to be discovered. He's taking Tasmania to the rest of the world. They have a brand that's synonymous with high quality. 500,000 people live it, but 1 million people actually visit it. So that's double the population that ecotourism or tourism as such brings to Tasmania. The Tasmanian visitor economy generates more than any other state. There's a whole-of-government coordinated strategy called T21, which brings together all agencies of government and tourism industry to see how they can lead the economy in tourism and ease strain on precious areas, make sure there are enough beds, allowing Tasmanians to continue to enjoy the state but not love it to death. Most people come to do nature activities. UNESCO actually says if you get people to natural places, you encourage awareness of how important those areas are. Tasmania did an expression of interest on what tourism activities, enterprises could actually occur in that state, and those activities were able to produce some nice niche businesses, but as a part of a larger landscape, they offer access to landscapes and bring people to Tasmania now in record numbers. As I said, ecotourism is no longer a niche business in Tasmania. Rob Pennicott wouldn't be a stranger to most people who have visited Hobart. He is the Managing Director and the founder of the award-winning Pennicott Wilderness Journeys at Tasmania. So if you've ever gone out on one of their little harbour cruises, etc., Rob Pennicott was probably the guy who had the vision for that particular industry. It certainly makes Tassie a great destination, and a lot of money. He uses a lot of his money in social media. He's also the founding member of the Tasmanian Coast Conservation Fund. Brad Godfrey, former CEO of Virgin Airlines, as I mentioned, heads up Tasmania Walking Company, and with 300,000 ecotourism operators now in Australia, he says it's most important that we continue to, or they continue, to reinvent themselves and remain relevant to what the broader community is demanding. We must market the aspiration, the best stuff. The value of the Australian dollar doesn't affect numbers of people coming to Australia, it just affects how much they spend. He said that initiatives such as bringing Oprah and Modern Family filming here into Australia and The Best Job in the World definitely bring people from other countries. But he also stated that we're missing the real opportunities in marketing. Adventure travel is now the highest growing area and provides the greatest spend. It covers guided walking tours, staying in lodges that are low impact and not having to carry a shovel for the toilet, which is always a bonus, having a glass of wine while you're doing it, not while you're in the toilet, just checking that you're listening, councillors. Hot showers. So what they're saying is the old traditional, pop up a tent and not have those luxuries is probably a past experience, and we need to improve that. Glad to know that you are actually listening, councillors. Interesting to note that, you know, that lots of zip lines and things like that are certainly popping up over there, and, some of the products that we got to see where zip lines actually wrap around trees rather than just go straight up and down. Well, not even a slingshot, no. So, great opportunities for adventure tourism. For what it's worth, New Zealand is ranked number 3. And what I was saying before is that people of our age are sort of people looking for these types of holidays. When I say our age, those around 50. Most of you are probably younger than that. And the fact is a lot of Australians leave Australia to go overseas to do these great walks. In fact, I was one of those when I visited Canada. They've got some amazing trails. And those people can also help influence environmental policy once they visit. Godfrey has spent 2 years going around the world looking for the best lodges. Uluru National Park ran expressions of interest for operators for luxury accommodation. It's not open slather, it's about sensitivity, but we need to do these things to get a greater share of the ecotourism market. So there are opportunities. The Asian market already comes to Australia for fresh air and blue sky. They come to Sydney, but we need to get them to other places. Tourism in Tasmania is going to be the number one service pillar, overtaking education. So, like I said, he's based in Brisbane, and he's already agreed to have a meeting with me. Council, I've got 8 pages, but I'll just quickly skim over the other people that were speakers and delegates that I think will be of value to our city. Wendy Hills, Acting Director of Customer Experience Division, New South Wales National Parks and Wildlife Service. In New South Wales, there are 6 Indigenous businesses that operate in national parks. Industry definitely are the experts, and they bring a great deal of knowledge to share with government around how successfully ecotourism opportunities can be delivered. Tamara O'Shea, she's the DG here in Queensland for National Parks, Sport and Racing. And she also demonstrated and talked about the fact we need cultural tourism strategy for the broader Queensland. David Major, Executive Director of Visitor Engagement and Conservation Parks Victoria, is a not-for-profit sector leading the world in ecotourism, and definitely not government. They say their business is actually not just in, well, it's not in tourism, it's in health and well-being. We are in the health business for people. Dr. Kay Booth, a very good speaker, Department of Conservation New Zealand, wanted to shift the conversation about what is the best way to invest money into conservation in New Zealand, grow the conservation pie, and educate more New Zealanders about conservation to future-proof it. She said we need to link mental health with healthy parks, need to put a shout-out to companies who are doing the right thing, and challenge governments that were there. How do they actually give credit to people who do the right thing? And that was another discussion, actually, just to step aside from this particular ecotourism and innovation roundtable, where we need to actually celebrate those successes of those businesses and innovation that are making ground and doing good things. She also used other examples of volunteerism, particularly in Auckland, and talked about the US government initiating things such as the Great Lodges of Yellowstone. They set really strict guidelines, but at the end of the day, it brings investment, brings people, and it teaches people about conservation. We heard from Vince Coulthard. I mentioned he's the CEO of Andjimanthana Traditional Land Association in the Flinders, and clearly the focus there was on how Indigenous cultural heritage plays a role in ecotourism. Ben O'Hara, General Manager, Land and Environment from the Gainsdale Group. For those of you who've been out towards the Scenic Rim, they're doing some great work out there. And it's fair to say that the challenges for doing something through national parks in Queensland is probably greater than other places in Australia. It's taken them something like 8 years to try and develop something where they will invest their own money in building paths and connections across national parks and the Scenic Rim. He's happy to share that knowledge with us, and I'm hoping to be able to get further information for all of you. That will include information about their 4 and 6 day walking tours and bike riding trails through the property that they have with glamping. Craig Wickham, he's the owner of the Exceptional Kangaroo Island, he basically talked about taking away technology when you have these nature walks. Probably the couple of lines I'll share with you that he mentioned in his presentation, that obviously the guides have to be great leaders. They need to know what they're talking about, and they need to, in this case, represent the Kangaroo Island brand. Their line is discover things that really matter. And their other line, which kind of resonates with me, is no Facebook, just faces and books. Look deep into the nature and you'll understand everything. And that was an Einstein quote that he used. Jason Mundy, Assistant Secretary, Parks Australia. Their vision for Parks Australia is to have outstanding natural places that enhance Australia's well-being. In Cairns, for example, they are building large street poles that mirror what the reef looks like, i.e. coral over street poles, as most people won't ever get to go to the reef. So bringing, once again, the experience to the people. Chris Thomas, South Australia Department of Environment, Water and Natural Resources, says that 80% of people come to South Australia for the nature. It's about celebrating the story. For example, whales on the migratory path. I talked a little bit. The Three Capes track is really something that I think has opportunities for us to learn from, particularly when we talk about North Stradbroke Island. So there were a few speakers in that space. Dr. Claire Ellis, Tourism Industry Council Tasmania, and consulting business. It's been a 10-year journey for that walk to be created. And the most important thing was that they all stuck together. They didn't start fighting with each other. There were various groups involved. And everyone said they needed to build it, even the people who didn't live in that part of the world. So a message for us is you've got to be collaborative and, I guess, make sure that consensus remains even when things get tough. Ben Clark, Three Capes Track, once again. Took a decade of work to get to the track. Over 400 people were involved. They started working on it in 2007, put in a booking fee, walked in one direction. They capped numbers on the walk. They started with 60 great short walks back in 1990, but obviously they need to keep up the track service, and a high standard of tourism signage and interpretation is very important. They actually have created and they need an overland track management plan. They form a group to see what makes a track iconic. This is how they actually worked out where the track was going to go. There was once again, Andrew Hennessy from Pennicott Wilderness Journeys, who they actually take the walkers to the Cape. So they could have actually done a 5-minute boat trip to get to this walk, but instead they actually did a 75-minute cruise to get their walkers from Port Arthur to start the walk. So they've added on value to what they do in their journeys. Dave Mason, founder of Mountain Trails, designed and constructed the track. Would have been a huge task. 35 kilometres, mostly wired and gravel, needs to be sustainable, needs to be safe. Materials were lifted in there by helicopter or 18,000 flights, employed 30 people, 5-year construction process, including 4 years to build the track. It actually allows the walkers to lift their eyes from the track so you can take in the view. Scott Verdell, he's the director of Jaws Australia. He built the three lodges at Three Capes Track based in Hobart. So there are different types of accommodation on this walk. There's the private one, which is a little bit more upmarket, and there's one that's supported by National Parks in Hobart. They actually, believe it or not, fly in and out their grey water, so they don't leave it there. The black water, they actually, the grey water is let out into trenches, but they actually have to move out the black water after every tour. It's simple and it's elegant. Andrew Reutz, General Parks Manager, General Manager Parks Tasmania, he's in charge of keeping those public huts, as I just described, and they just won the best new tourism, business tourism award. 41% of people who use that track stay at least one night somewhere in that direct area. Places like oyster farms and wineries are seeing a big jump. It's a higher end spend. They have room for 48 walkers for those of you who might be planning a trip to Tasmania. And they also have two guides. They are building two huts. Some of those huts will have hot showers, massages, fine wine, and the price will be between $2,000 and $2,500 per person. Ian Johnston, the Maria Island Walk and Chair, Great Walks of Tasmania. Sorry? Oh, pardon. Okay. Thank you. Mariah Island Walk. Spelt Maria, but said Mariah. They're actually our competitors. He talked about our competitors in the ecotourism space. Is it another country or is it actually Harvey Norman who is selling his new TV? His walks have 10 guests. Two guides and advocates for walks that are not in each other's patch but spread around. One to progress the industry and develop the destination. So, councillors, that's a pretty quick summary. I'll make sure there's copies of this available for you. I'll be testing you all later. There are some. there was at least one interested person in the gallery, so. Okay, good on you. So there are some associated reference documents and these as well. And if you have any questions, feel free to ask me. Sorry, I recommend the opportunity for those of you who want to experience how you can be involved with developing some of those strategies we have to take that opportunity as afforded in our policy. Thank you. There you go. Thank you. All right. It was tiring, but it was great. It was cold. It was actually really cold. Thank you. We are now up to petitions, and I believe Councillor Tolte has a petition to present.
Thank you, Madam Mayor. You want me to move it first? So I would move that the petition is of an operational nature relating to an application currently assessed under the Sustainable Planning Act and be received and referred to the Chief Executive Officer for consideration.
Move Councillor Tolte, seconded Councillor Edwards. Would you like to speak to it, Councillor Tolte?
Yes, please, Madam Mayor. This is a petition that has around 100 signatures on it from my residence in Division 6 at Redland Bay. It relates to an area of land at 899 to 901 German Church Road, which, for anyone who's familiar with German Church Road, Redland Bay, is opposite where the cage currently operates. Pardon? I'll read a statement from the residents. They've written a covering letter to go with their petition. Their petition actually asks for consideration of a change of zoning on this land from light industrial to residential because they believe the use will be more in keeping with the current use in the surrounding areas. This is a little bit unusual for us. We often have petitions come in that are against an application, and this is not specifically about the application, but we do currently have an application being assessed in the planning department to ask for the light industrial zoning to be overridden to allow residential use on this site. And the residents who live in the surrounding area are supporting that application rather than protesting it, so that's nice for a change. They are asking that we consider a change of zoning in the land from 847 to 897 German Church Road, Redland Bay, from light industrial to residential zoning in use, as it will be in keeping with the current use in the surrounding area. They argue that there's a large industrial area approximately 600 metres away that is at the moment heavily underutilised and is only at stage 2 of 4. They note that they've been successful in easily collecting 100 signatures from the 100 homes immediately around this development site, and 100% of the people that they asked to sign the petition were happy to do so. all of the residents, and I get a lot of feedback on this from the housing estates around this piece of land, would much rather see a residential estate in this family-orientated community than an industrial development. Residents raised the following concerns during discussions and door knocking. There's no place for an industrial development amongst our residential community. They would rather walk their families through housing and parks than industrial buildings. They wouldn't feel safe with their children walking to school past an industrial estate, particularly with the increasing transfer of trucks and vans. Local families and many of our older residents walk their dogs along German Church Road are concerned about the amount of heavy trucks, vans coming in and out of an industrial estate in this position. Why is there a need for another industrial estate when the Redlands Business Park is underutilised at second stage of four stages? The residents that are a participant in this petition love their little part of Redlands and living in Redland Bay. There's no hesitation from residents when faced with the choice of having an industrial development in their backyard. They would much rather welcome new families into the community that they're so proud of. And they thank us for considering their concerns and their petition.
So we have a move and a second. Can I put the motion, councillors? Those in favour? Those against? Motion is carried unanimously. Next item, councillors, is order of business. I don't believe there's any motion to change the order of business, councillors, so I'll just remind you then of your material personal interest and conflict of interest under the Local Government Act 2009. Summary of those responsibilities are in your agenda, councillors. All right, item 11.1.1 are the monthly financial reports, and I believe, Councillor Edward, you happy to move that?
Yes, thank you. Item 11.1.1, December 2016, monthly financial reports. I move the officer's recommendation to note the report.
Move Councillor Edwards. Seconded Councillor Gollay. Would you like to speak to it, Councillor Edwards?
Just briefly. Council reported a year-to-date operating surplus of $3.07 million. Our bulk water consumption was higher than forecast, which resulted in increased revenue. Council's capital works program is $2.5 million behind target, however, it is an improvement on previous years, and due to the timing of works plan, this could still catch up. All key performance indicators have been met, with the exception of the asset sustainability ratio. Our cash holdings are just above $150 million, of which $101 million is constrained reserves. Borrowings stand at only $43 million. Council remains in a strong financial position. Having presented a great financial result at the financial mid-year point, I must point out that we have expenditure challenges in the second half of this year, and it is important that we continue to have a sharp eye on the bottom line.
Thank you, Councillor Edwards. Any other speakers? Any speaker against? If I could just raise probably one thing, and just a great intro to Peter Best, our General Manager of Infrastructure and Operations, is that in regards to the capital, you know, the spending of capital, that we will be keeping a very strict eye on that, and we note that it's currently there's a bit of an underspend there at the moment. We're a bit anal about trying to make sure we only raise the money that we spend in a year, and we are getting better at it, but that will be certainly something that myself and councillors will be focusing on to make sure that that capital spend is proceeding as budgeted, as close to as possible. Any other comments, councillors? Otherwise, a great set of figures. Once again, I think the point that Councillor Edwards makes is very pertinent, that we will be facing some challenges, and so therefore we need to keep a really close eye on what's happening. Okay, with that, I'll if there's no summing up, Councillor Edwards, I'll put the motion. Those in favour? Those against? The motion is carried unanimously. Thank you, councillors. The next item will be the Queensland Audit Office Financial Management Report. Councillor Edwards, do you want to present that?
Thank you. Item 11.1.2, Queensland Audit Office Final Management Report 2015-16. I move the officer's recommendation to note the report.
So moved. A seconder, Councillor Mitchell. Would you like to speak to it, Councillor Edwards?
Briefly, this report presents the final management report for 2015-16 by the Queensland Audit Office. The key findings were discussed with the external auditors during Council's Audit Committee meeting held on the 13th of October 2016. Council's internal audit group coordinates the action items agreed to the observation report and provides a progress report to the executive leadership team on a monthly basis.
Speakers
speaker against? Comment?
Thank you, Madam Mayor. I did ask some questions of officers yesterday, and they were just clarification, which I met with officers and was more than comfortable with the questions I had, and noted that it was a 2015-16 a report, so that was great. Some of the timing of the questions was just something that I wanted to be clear about, so that, thank you very much to officers for that. And I just think that as Councillor Edwards mentioned, keeping a sharp eye on the bottom line, I just think as we move forward, some of the areas that are identified, just encouraging us to make sure that the asset management project is aligned, and I just want to make sure that we as councillors are doing everything possible to make sure that we have clear line of sight between audit and the PMO office and the way we actually get the different departments to do their asset management, so we can get all of that lined up going forward. And I thank very much the officers, and it's a great result.
Once again, it's credit to Deb's team, Deborah Corbett-Hall, in regards to another great report from the Audit Office. Well done. With that, if there's no other questions... question, Councillor Elliott?
Yeah, through you to the CFO. A question yesterday, and I don't know why we didn't have a follow-up with the...
Well, because there wasn't time yesterday, wasn't Councillor. Time.
There's no date. It's on the audit QAO part. It's in... Business Improvement Opportunity Capitalisation of Bulk Assets. Our recommendation, this is QAO, is whilst the current treatment is in line with the accounting standards, our recommendation provides for ease of administration and is also standard practice of other councils. While it's not mandatory to council, this treatment is also in line with the Queensland Treasury Corp guidelines. But we're saying, however, we do not we do not consider necessary. Why is that?
Thank you, Madam Mayor. Through you to the Councillor. Thank you for the question. We abide by the Australian Accounting Standards Board, the accounting standards in Australia. So we had really robust discussion with Bentleys on this topic. The approach that we're taking is we believe it's most appropriate in terms of the refuse bins. So the topic in discussion is around our waste bins, and we bulk those together. So in terms of an accounting standards, we are 100% compliant, and that's the standard that we work towards. We talk through some guidelines, some other documentation, but here at Redland City Council we choose to follow the accounting standards. That's the legal requirement. So we're compliant with accounting standards, but we don't support the approach where the auditors are saying what you could do is recognise assets individually.
They allude to ease, provides ease of administration. What's that mean?
Depending on which side of the argument you're sitting on, so we would not necessarily suggest that would be ease of administration for us. Obviously, we try and look very pragmatically at the way we do our accounting at Redland City Council. It's in accordance with the accounting standards, and we think it's the right thing to do for the community. So happy to talk to the detail either here or offline. But in terms of the waste bins, they're very much one in, one out. So if we wanted to look at... individually accounting for those waste bins, 66,000 properties in the city, I wouldn't necessarily say that's in finance or Redland City Council's best interest to do that approach.
I sort of question, you know, like every other council does it and we don't, and I always question those sort of things, you know. When you're the odd one out, there's a reason, you know. Yeah, that's all I'm asking.
Yeah, thanks again. Through the chair, every other council doesn't do it like that, so I'm happy to send you what might be of benefit is if I send you the best practice guide that the QAO was pointing us to, and then we can look through that and see if that's the way we want to move towards. So I believe as CFO we're doing the accounting treatment that's in accordance with the accounting standards and in the best interest of our community, but more than happy to put the other view forward and we can have a discussion around it. I'm mindful you've not had access to that other document that we can talk to.
So, if I may, Councillor Elliott, as well, I think, Deb, if my memory serves me correct, this was discussion with our external two auditors that sit on there, so they were comfortable. I think comfortable is the right word rather than... because they could see both sides of the arguments on that. And it's probably a good timely reminder for councillors to, if you can, try and attend the audit committees. You do get a lot of detailed information through there. You do get it firsthand. These reports are a summary. And again, from my experience, let me tell you, if I got every one of these in every organisation that I run with the responses we get here, I'd be a very happy CEO. This is a fantastic report. It is a fantastic response. Deb and the team have to be congratulated, the amount of work, and you only have to go onto the QAO website and read some of the audits that they have given of similar entities and similar, you know, entities. We've got water as well, to see how, you know, well we are doing. And these, whilst, again, I can understand if you are not deeply involved in these, deficiencies and those sort of things, again, when you pay auditors, typically, if they came with a clean bill of health, we would then start to question why we're paying them a significant amount of money to audit our books. So, again, a great result, Councillor, and I do encourage you to come along and listen to the debate by our external auditors who take us and challenge us quite regularly in those audit committees.
Look, I think it's fair to say, too, that this isn't the first time that finance team have done an outstanding job, so they are consistent. And one of the challenges, I was sitting on the outside looking in, is that standards are changing all the time, and there's different standards, and sometimes you've got to pick your mark and you've got to stick with it, otherwise you'd spend more time adjusting your systems and processes than you would actually be delivering the service on the ground that the community expects. So this is a really good, this is one page, you know, basically compared to chapters that other councils deal with. The team does a great job. Any other questions? Councillor Gleeson.
Thanks, Madam Mayor. As the relatively new Chair of the Audit Committee, I've got to say I'm constantly surprised about the depth and of the investigation from the external auditors and the QAO. And once again, as you've said to Deb and the team, you know, I think they do a fantastic job, and the responses are always readily available to the QAO and very transparent for those who are in the meetings. Thank you.
Thank you. If there are no further questions or comments, would you like to sum up, Councillor Edwards?
Nothing further to add, thanks.
Okay, well, I'll put the motion then, councillors. Those in favour? Those against? Motion is carried unanimously. The next item, councillors, is 11.2.1, and I believe Councillor Hughes is going to move that item.
Thank you, Mayor. I'd like to propose moving the motion 11.2.1, decisions made under delegated authority for Category 1, 2 and 3 applications. Thank you.
Thank you, Councillor Hughes. Move, Councillor Hughes, seconded Councillor Tolte. Would you like to speak to it, Councillor Hughes?
Yes, thank you. For noting that this report covers the 5 weeks from the 27th of November last year, 2016, all the way through to the 7th of the 1st, 17. That's 5 weeks while we've had the holiday period. So really, if you look at it on the first page, you might have thought not a lot. Hang on, there's a bit more there.
Thank you, Councillor Hughes. Any questions, councillors? Just an item for noting. If not, I'll put the motion. Those in favour? Those against? The motion is carried. Councillor Hughes, 11.2.2.
Thank you, Mayor. 11.2.2, Planning and Environment Court Matters List, current as at the 10th of January 2017. Thank you.
So moved by Councillor Hughes. So I guess seconder, Councillor Tolte. Would you like to speak to it, Councillor?
Thank you. It's self-explanatory, and a note that the officer's recommendation that Council resolves to note this report. Thank you.
Any questions, councillors? I think we're going to get a briefing on Environment P&E Court Matters next week, so if we want to save it for then. Yep. Okay, no further discussion. I'll put the motion. Those in favour? Those against? The motion is carried. Item 11.2.3, what we might do with this... 11.2.3 is just a housekeeping matter. Councillor Hughes, sorry, I'm jumping ahead of myself.
Thank you, Mayor. 11.2.3, and I just note CPNA amendments to fees and charges schedule 16-17 split valuation contribution, S in brackets SVC fee is the heading. And for those, these documents do go out to the public. The CPNA, one of my biggest bugbears as a new councillor, is learning all of these acronyms, absolutely. And just to clarify that, city planning and assessment. Thank you very much. Moving that.
Move, Councillor Hughes, seconded Councillor Tolte. No discussion on that, Councillor Hughes?
No, I did make a phone call and follow up on it just to ensure what it was. Obviously, very small increase. That increase is set by the Department of Natural Resources, and ultimately it's a sealing fee. The application comes in, we seal it, and off it goes. Thank you.
No other questions, councillors? I'll put the motion. Those in favour? Those against, the motion is carried unanimously. Okay, item 11.2.4, I'm going to have the officers present, if I may, if you'd like to come forward and before we take that motion. Oh dear.
Madam Mayor, CEO and councillors, this is a presentation. Oh no, I'm happy to stand up if I'm not looking untidy. So just wishing to present the report with regard to the mixed-use development, apartment building, tourist accommodation, refreshment establishment and shop at 4 Harbourview Court, 144A Shore Street, Cleveland. So the purpose is to briefly provide some background as to the proposal in some detail, and the officer's recommendation. You each have a copy of the report, officer's report, with attachments, which will be referred to from time to time. So just as a background to the development, as was presented yesterday and discussed at the workshop, the site is immediately north of the Cleveland Railway Station and is on the site of the current commuter car park. The car park itself is not part of the application, and the railway transport infrastructure is exempt development under Schedule 4 of the Sustainable Planning Act. The proposal on the site is an apartment building with 118 units, tourist accommodation of 6 units, refreshment establishment and a shop. The podium level of the development will be at a height of 9 metres. Two separate towers will be 15 metres apart with an overall height of 29 metres. Stage 1 will be a commuter car park, which will essentially have a roofed structure over it, which will be the start of the two towers. The refreshment establishment and the shop also form part of Stage 1. Stage 2 will be the apartment building, the two towers and the tourist accommodation. There were a number of key issues that were considered as part of the application, and these were land use, building design and gateway siting, setbacks, communal open space, car parking, pedestrian pathway, which is just to the north of the site, and impact on a tree. So the land use is encouraged on this area for mixed use development, and that is compatible with the rail uses and incorporates such items as terminals, interchange, apartment buildings, commercial activities, and retail uses. And the proposal is a mixed use development, and it has been determined to meet these requirements. With regard to the building design, certainly the proposal is to increase interaction with the street. A pedestrian amenity will be improved, and there will be a ground store, ground level cafe and kiosk opening on the corner of Shore Street and Harbourview Court. The expanse of the car park will be screened and will be not viewed from Harbourview Court. There'll be a prominent street interface treatment, and there'll be deep podium planting. And there will be a gap between the two towers, and this will maintain views to the bay. There will be considerable open space provided, communal open space, as part of the apartment buildings, and 20% of the podium level will be provided for that open space, and these will include a lap pool, two barbecue areas, a gymnasium and some informal seating areas. With regard to the car parking proposed with the development is as per the probable solution is 162,
and this area is subject to the incentive package, which allows for car parking rates to be reduced. And this development is located in an area, and in the area where it is determined that a transit-orientated development is appropriate, and the parking rates for that have been determined as being one parking space per residential unit, and therefore the development complies with the Redlands planning scheme. With regard to the pedestrian pathway, which is adjacent to the development, the apartment building will be designed such that it will allow additional casual surveillance to the pedestrian pathway. It will include, as part of the proposal, additional lighting to this pathway, security cameras and CCTV services, and the development of Lot 1, which is immediately west of the subject lot, will improve pedestrian safety and clear visibility to the path to the footpath. With regard to impact on trees, there is a single eucalyptus located on the corner site. That has been determined that whilst it is in good, healthy condition, it may pose some safety to the public in extreme weather conditions. And due to the most efficient use of the land, it has been determined that the tree will be permitted to be removed. The developer has proposed some compensating planting of native trees along Harbourview Court. Also has proposed additional planting of trees in the park opposite the site. So the recommendation from the officers is that this development be approved, subject to conditions, and those conditions are included within the development, within the report. There is one additional matter that I forgot to mention, and that was with regard to temporary car parking being proposed. So due to the construction occurring, the commuter car park will obviously not be able to be utilised for a period. The applicant has proposed an alternative car park, and that's to be located on the RPAC site. Approximately 78 car parking spaces will be provided there, and the car park will be left permanently in that location for council to determine what to do with that in the future. As part of that, there is an infrastructure agreement in place that is also included as an attachment, and as part of that infrastructure agreement, the developer is to provide safe and practical pedestrian access between the rail station and the temporary car park. There's some details with regard to that in Schedule 2.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Councillor Hughes, are you happy to move an alternative?
Okay, you might have to help me a little here. So do I move the report first?
Move the alternative recommendation, Councillor. I think we had a discussion about this yesterday. It's the best way for us to get the outcomes that have been articulated by people in the community in discussion, bearing in mind that we understand that there's three or four ways we could deal with this, but I think Councillor Hughes is a way
forward. I'll start that then. At this morning's general meeting with regard to item 11.2.4, MCU 013612, mixed-use development, 4 Harbourview Court and 144A Shore Street, Cleveland, I propose to reject the officer's recommendation and propose the following amendment. Thank you. Yes, it's
you need to read that out, Councillor.
Okay, and Joyce has it to go up on the screen, that Council resolves to issue a preliminary approval for the material change of use for apartment building, tourist accommodation, refreshment establishment and shop on an allotment-zoned major centre, MC5, on land described as Lot 2, SP273106, situated at 4 Harbourview Court, Cleveland, subject to the following matters being addressed. Number one, provide sufficient...
So with that, I think Council's actually... Oh, yes. I don't think it's been changed. No, I think councillors received. This is what you distributed yesterday to councillors, Tracy.
That's correct this morning, and Joyce has a copy of that, and you had it highlighted, ready to go up on the screen.
Is
no, I sent it this morning.
Is can you just check the words up there, make sure they're the same as yours that was sent out?
No. I haven't seen that.
Okay, councillor. So, can you please forward?
That was, we had two. I've emailed out 2 points.
Is this the one that Chris forwarded to us yesterday? Oh, you have amended it. So councillors haven't seen this.
It was emailed to all councillors this morning.
Oh, okay. Well, I haven't had a chance to read. Can you send that to Joyce, please? Well, Joyce has got a different.
Yes, it's done. It was done this morning. I thought that was what was going up on the screen when I went and saw Joyce this morning.
Yeah. My understanding is you sent one out yesterday. There was one sent out yesterday as well.
That was the draft with Chris. That's not correct. The first email. There was two emails. What was just flashed on the screen is the alternate. The potential grant. Yep, that's it.
Okay.
What was...
No. Sorry, we need to have a mover and seconder before we can go into. Oh, sorry.
Just check with Councillor Hughes if that is her amended motion.
Is that your amended motion? What's the difference there?
Yes.
Okay, we had four conditions and you've only got two.
I've not seen that from Chris at all. I don't know how that.
Councillor Boglari?
I had a conversation with the officer this morning, and I sent to Councillor Hughes after discussions today in this meeting if it was agreed to add them onto, but it hadn't been added onto formally yet.
Councillor...
So this is the correct... Councillor Hughes is correct. This is the motion.
Okay. All right, Councillor Hughes. So I'm just making sure that councillors have read this. I haven't received it because I haven't been able to attend to my emails yet this morning. So, but this is... No, we haven't even got a motion yet, Councillor. So settle down, everyone. So this is the motion that Councillor Hughes is putting forward as written up on the board. And just to make sure everyone's clear, Councillor, can you just read out Condition 1 and 2, please?
Condition 1, provide sufficient car parking for the apartment building use that meets specific outcome S8 of the apartment building code and specific outcome S1 of the access and parking code as per the Redland Planning Scheme version 7.1. That was number 1. Number 2, design the development in a way that retains and protects the existing eucalyptus species located at Lot 3 on SP273106, 144A Shore Street West, Cleveland, intact.
Thank you, Councillor.
Do you want me to speak to that?
I'll need a seconder before we do that. I just want to be clear because there's another motion that I've seen. This includes a 25% increase in car parking space, correct? Just get an office from the... So this is a version of what we saw yesterday. Just get a nod from the officer. Yes, it's a 25% increase in parking and the removal of the retention, pardon me, of the eucalyptus. So that's fine. Okay. All right. So everyone understands that. I need a seconder. Thank you. Seconded Councillor Mitchell. Would you now like to speak to... My apologies, Councillor, for the confusion, but obviously we had a bit of discussion about this yesterday.
Is that going up the board now?
That's it. I'm just getting a second... Well, no, I'll just ask if that actually meant that. Because in the original one that I saw yesterday, it talked about an extra of 25%. So just making that clear before we get a seconder so we know what we're debating. So 25% increase in parking. Okay, so I've got a seconder in Councillor Mitchell, and now Councillor Hughes, you may speak to this if you wish.
Following some very robust discussions and options that we were looking at, we have I'm leading and coming up with this alternate motion. The strength of the motion is that if we can condition this these two changes with the developer, we can ensure that the car parking is increased, and we can ensure that that tree that I absolutely reject what's happened in the report. That tree, the quoting of your words, a matter of time and at some stage, this tree has got a longevity predicted of 200 years, and I believe we should do everything in our power to ensure that that tree has the best opportunity it can. It's referred to as a Sydney blue gum. It is, and I quote, a known feed tree for koalas in our city. That's very, very valuable, and I will hold everything I can in my power to keep that tree. So the strength of the motion is that we could ensure those things going back to the developer. I understand a weakness in this motion is that if the developer chooses to go to court, we only defend these 2 points. So I'd just like to clarify that. We will only have an opportunity to defend these 2 points. So in keeping with that, I have distributed also, which was briefly flashed on the screen, potential grounds for outright refusal of this development.
Councillor, we can't debate that right now.
Okay, I'm just saying that there is an alternate that I can't move.
So standing orders, we have a seconder. You have an opportunity to speak to this motion and nothing else. And if you've done with that, I'll ask for a speaker against.
And then, just in summing up, if...
You don't get to sum up now. You get to sum up later.
In what... All right.
So as a mover of the motion, you'll get to sum up after the debate. That's the bonus you get if you think it's a bonus. Councillor Gleeson, you're a speaker against.
Thanks, Madam Mayor. I note the increase of the 29 additional car parks, but I'll point out that that's only for resident car parking, and there's no plan to extend the car park.
I'm actually going to stop you there because it was made very clear to us that we have absolutely no control over the QR car space. So just to be really clear, that is a completely separate issue. We can't make them provide more commuter car parking under this application.
In principle, I'm not going to support this application at all without an increase in community car parking that's going to satisfy future needs. State government don't own any other land around there, and all they're going to do is push the pressure onto council and future councils to provide car parking for their commuters. I don't have a problem with the development. Absolutely use the space, not a problem at all. But they should be allowing for future growth and future needs of that train station. It's sitting at the end of a train line with future growth in the area, and I think they're being very short-sighted
Point of order, Councillor Elliott, it is.
You've already advised the council this is the committee car park's not in the conversation.
Thank you. So, Councillor, we probably need to deal with the application in front of us and what council can actually condition or otherwise.
I can see this happening. This is just going to put pressure on future councils down the track to provide infrastructure for another level of government, and it's going to come back and bite future councils in the backside.
Speaker 4. Councillor Boglari.
I'm not a Speaker 4, Madam Mayor. I just wanted to ask, could we go into informal discussion?
No, because it becomes a circus, frankly. We have debated this. We've had this 4 or 5 times discussion. You've been prepared. No, we're not going into... unless councillors want to go into informal, we've got a couple of motions that have been proposed. You discussed it. I'm not encouraging that.
It was just since the workshop yesterday, councillors have been discussing it, and if I may, I'd like to seek a vote from the councillors if they would allow us to go into informal discussion.
I'd much prefer then that you suspend meeting, councillor, and we ask people to move so that you can have honest and open debate. Suspend the proceedings. Well, my understanding
I'm happy to talk about it, because it was exactly what Councillor Gleeson just said then. Our main concern is this car parking, and that the state government has done a blanket approach and allowed developers to go into...
Your point of order, Councillor Elliott?
Same as the first point of order.
But that's exactly what my point is.
Councillors,
we have to get this explanation out there to the residents.
Councillor Boglari, the point of order has been called. You are not talking to the topic in front of us. That is part of the standing orders. We understand the frustration, each and every one of us do, but this is not the place where you can have that debate. The debate is about the application that was provided to you last week, has been presented to you a number of times, and that we talked about yesterday, and we talked about the best way to manage this to address the community's concerns. So we spent 2 hours yesterday, and you have to understand that this is formal proceedings, and for that reason you can speak for and against. I'll allow you to ask questions, but we're not going to continue to suspend meeting orders, meeting proceedings, when we've had plenty of time to be able to talk about this.
My point was, it's an emotive issue in the community.
Correct.
And if I'm going to be backed into a corner to vote for a development that I actually don't agree with some
Councillor,
outcomes from,
no one's
it,
backing you in the... You have formal proceedings...
Well, the state government has, I
Thank
feel.
Thank you, Councillor.
And that's why I wanted
I'm going
an
to refer
open
you,
discussion.
I'm going to refer you to the standing orders. This is not how we have debate. You've adopted the standing orders. You have an opportunity to ask questions through that process. You have an opportunity to speak for and against it. We currently have a live motion... and we haven't even started the debate, so if I'm not going to suspend standing orders in light of that. We haven't even started the debate. We've had one person move the motion, and we're speaking to it. So if you want to speak against it, you're more than welcome to.
Oh, well, if you're not going to suspend standing orders, then I can't speak at the moment because you're up to a four, but I would just like to...
Oh, it's an against, Councillor.
No. Four was against. It was up for a four. But I thought when
I have
the councillor
a, well, you, thank
asked
you,
for
but
a
I,
vote on going
right.
into
well, you
informal
didn't,
discussion, is
sorry.
It just the decision of the chair, or was it supposed to be? Or
I have a speaker. I have a speaker who wants to speak for it.
My question. I apologise, but my question was: is when a councillor requests that we go into informal discussion, is the decision?
Have you
of
got
the
your standing orders there, councillor?
I don't think it's actually on that bit.
Well, you have an opportunity to speak against it because I have a speaker for, and I did ask for a speaker for when you asked this question, so if you wouldn't mind letting me allow that speaker speak to the motion before you...
And then if the CEO could get back to me if that vote does get put up or whether it's the decision of the chair.
Speaker for, councillors.
Thank you, Madam Mayor. Yes, I'm speaking in favour of the amended motion that Councillor Hughes has put up there, and I'm focusing solely on the application which is before us, which we can make... assessment on. To my mind, there is a deficiency in car parking. If we were to refuse this application, I think that the developer has rather sound grounds to challenge us in court, and that would leave us in an invidious position where we've got no position to alter the application that's before us to have a better outcome. So by supporting this resolution, at least the applicant has the ability to consider what we're providing and can come back with us with alternate plans in which we are seeking the extra parking and saving the tree as well. Having said that, they might challenge us on that as well, and they've probably got pretty good grounds too. So it's one of those situations where we come across time and time again. We've got officers... recommendations based on planning grounds, why the application submitted is compliant, unless we've got really strong grounds to defend our position if we were to reject it, which I don't believe we have. I think this is the best way forward to try and get a better outcome, and hopefully through negotiation we'll achieve something much better than was originally placed before us. I understand all the concerns about all the other issues around, but really we have no control over that. I'd rather get a better outcome than try and stop something and it comes through and we have a worse out. We have what's presented to us initially and you can't change that. So this is the only way we can move forward and have an attempt at getting a better outcome for the community.
I'll just get an officer to explain the process of a development preliminary approval versus an approval or refusal for that matter, so the public understand.
Okay. The current application before us is for a development approval. That was the officer's recommendation. The amended motion provided by Councillor Hughes is for a preliminary approval, which essentially gives the applicant certainty that Council is okay with the general concept of a development on that site of that style. However, it does set some additional requirements that Council wish the developer to make some changes to their application before they resubmit their development permit. So that's essentially the process. However, there are some other alternatives. If the applicant chooses, they may wish to take the matter straight to the P&E court, in which case it would just be determined by the court rather than coming back to council to consider further.
Just to be clear, a development permit will come back to council. If it goes straight to the P&E court, we're pretty much taken out of the loop. Okay, so that was a speaker for. Councillor Boglari, would you like to speak against?
Certainly. Am I allowed to seek points of clarification while speaking against? Which is why I wanted to move into...
Understanding orders, you can ask questions, yes.
Because I think with this one, I really do feel backed into a corner. I think the state government went out and they gave it to developers that they could use transit-oriented destinations for some development. My understanding is only a couple were taken up. One was Milton, one was Cleveland. How can you have a blanket approach to such totally different areas? Cleveland doesn't have the high density around it, and with the location in our city, people do drive to it. So it's very important that we don't hinder future opportunity there to have a decent Todd set up there. By restricting car parking spaces. Also, there's just a couple of points I'd like clarification on. John, you mentioned... you mentioned the pathway to the north is going to have actually increased surveillance, is it? I actually thought it was being a bit more entrapped.
Certainly... There's currently a chain wire fence against that site. That is a condition of the lease of the site. However, the pathway is vegetated in portions and somewhat narrow, and the proposal is to remove some of that vegetation that is creating sort of hidey holes and nooks and crannies. Also proposed to include additional lighting and also proposed to include CCTV cameras in that location as well.
Okay, well, sorry, I missed the CCTV cameras were going in there. Another concern is I disagree with additional car parking being put down at RPAC temporarily, yes, but I think RPAC in itself is what could be, and we've all thought of this previously, as a really good arts corner as an entry to Cleveland. So it's a bit of paving paradise, putting up a parking lot. But the pedestrians to get to RPAC, what are the actual, assistance in infrastructure that's actually going to go in there to help pedestrians get to the train station across the four lanes of traffic?
Thank you for the question. With regard to the temporary nature of the car parking, as part of the development, it is only intended to be temporary, and Council does have the option of asking for it to be removed if they so chose, but the offer from the developer is to leave the car parking, 78 spaces there, for Council to do as it wishes. So it could be to retain the 78 spaces, it could be to return it to a turfed environment, should that be the determination of council.
And while commuters are using it, what point of crossing will there be that is safe for them to get to the train station?
Yeah, thank you for that question. So certainly as part of the infrastructure agreement, which is in place between council and the developer, there are a number of requirements to provide for temporary pedestrian connectivity. The precise details obviously are yet to be worked out, but I will just make reference to a couple of those points within the schedule. And point B says temporary pedestrian connectivity to and from the railway station is to be provided during the development as required by an appropriate pedestrian access study commissioned by the developer to the satisfaction of council. The developer will consult, facilitate and manage the process between DTMR and council for the pedestrian links, and signage and wayfinding aids will be provided by the developer. So at this stage, the detail of those has not been determined, and that they would come at the operational level. And obviously those type of devices could in fact be a pedestrian crossing, or even signalised pedestrian signals may well be an option that is adopted in the short term. But there is a requirement on the developer to provide that, and it will be to the satisfaction of council and also to the Department of Transport and Main Road, who operates the two legs of the road that needs to be crossed.
Mm-hmm. And a point that Councillor Hughes did send out she's mentioned it to me somewhere along the line, and Councillor Bishop also mentioned this morning, in the master plan for Cleveland CBD, this area is actually like zoned for commercial. It's also got a car parking policy, which I don't have in front of me, but I know Councillor Bishop was reading it to me this morning about having to take into account communal car parking. Now, I know that the QR car parking and this application, we are told to keep separate, even though it is impacting negatively on it, but in our own master plan, it actually says we should consider it. Does our master plan have any weight here to actually get the state, because in theory I'm not against something being built there, but I am against us absolutely handcuffing any great future outcomes for a Todd there that will be user-friendly.
Might be a question.
With sufficient car parking.
Chris or Kim might want to add, because I think this was discussed yesterday.
But no, the car parking policy wasn't. We didn't.
Yeah, well, it was, but probably slightly in a different.
Oh, okay. Maybe Councillor Bishop could read it out. I don't have it in front of me.
So the question, Chris, is what weight does the master plan and the reference to including commuter parking in the mixed use development, not commercial, but mixed use, because I think you referred it to being commercial. I'm just wanting to make sure we understand.
Sit right up the front, Chris. Come up the front, mate.
There is.
So the Cleveland CBD Master Plan is a non-statutory strategy document. So it has a place in terms of council's policy-making decisions. It has no place in terms of a development assessment decision. So until the elements of the Cleveland Master Plan are incorporated into the planning scheme, they don't hold any power in development assessment sense. Elements of the Cleveland Master Plan were incorporated into the planning scheme, specifically the building heights in the Master Plan were incorporated in a major amendment to the planning scheme. So council made a decision at that stage to move those building heights into the planning scheme, but not the other elements of the master plan.
My understanding, bearing in mind the preliminary approval asks you to add 25% extra parking, and I would suggest that you refer to that piece of information that Councillor Bishop has sent around as one of your statements, part of your reason in your statement as to why you are increasing it by 25%, because you will also need to provide reasons for your preliminary approval. Okay, so just keep that in mind.
God, I did have another question. Now I've gone blank because I'm still it's concerning when it's been identified that commuter car parking did have to be taken into account, but we don't have anything strong enough in our planning scheme to actually go forward with it. And that's my main bugbearer.
Bearing in mind the preliminary approval does ask for 25% increased parking on the application, just to keep that, let's not lose sight of that.
Yeah. Can I just ask you, John, if this was to be not approved at all, with no preliminary approval but just refused, and it did go, I don't know whether you are able to answer this, sorry if I'm putting you on the spot, but if it was to go to court, what are the scenarios?
We might ask the legal
person. The legal person?
I think Jonathan actually...
I just think with all our documents that stack up to say that we should take communal car parking into account, that surely the state would say right.
We'll get Anthony to respond. Yeah. I think he heard the first time. Yeah.
Through you, Madam Chair. Chris summarised the issue quite correctly. If it's not adopted in the planning scheme, the court will consider the planning scheme and the expert assessment of that planning scheme. So if the parking conditions, constraints, limitations are not in the planning scheme, then the court won't be considering those aspects.
The fact that Redden City Council refused it, wouldn't the court think, okay, the council doesn't want it, what are those grounds, and actually look into it and realise that this blanket approach to development over every train station doesn't work in some situations, and actually have a look at how they could get it work more effectively down here? Wouldn't they consider the reasonings as to why we refused it?
The court's bound, as council is, with the provisions of the Sustainable Planning Act, so they have to act within those provisions. They might refer to the master plan, they might refer to policy documents, but they'll ask the question, are they adopted in the planning scheme as the statutory document? Now, if it's not, there'll be strong arguments to say they should not be considered at all. The court and council must consider the statutory document, being the planning scheme and the Sustainable Planning Act. Other policy decisions are policy decisions for council, not necessarily the court or the assessment process, which is quite strict.
Which is why we'd had the discussion about what method we should have to move forward with this particular application yesterday, and the options to us as to how we can best have some control over the outcomes without losing control. Did you want to add something?
I was just going to add, councillors, that you know, whichever way you decide to go on this with your grounds of things, if it goes to an appeal and it's at the P&E court, it is then up to the court. So that is the applicants will make their submissions, we will make ours, and then it is up to the court. And as you know, that's unappealable. I think that's the right terminology, isn't it, through the P&E?
Well, you can always appeal the Planning and Environment Court to the to the Court of Appeal, and then from the Court of Appeal to the High Court. It doesn't happen very often, but it's happened once.
So there is a process through there, and again, we need to remember, whilst Council will endeavour to support the will of the councillors on those grounds, we have to provide expert advice, and we are under the model litigant, so we do need to provide advice to the courts to help them make the appropriate decision. So it is one of those ones that it's up to the court once it gets there. So we encourage you strongly to have grounds that you believe are relevant, and officers can give you that advice, and you've heard that today, and that's up for you to make your decision process.
Speaker 4, Councillor... Sure, Councillor Elliott.
Councillor Boglari asked you about the management program to get them from A to B. You mentioned that it was council and the government had to approve it. I thought, from the conversation we had before this, it was up to the state.
I thought it was the state.
They had to provide management control.
Yeah, but I thought
plan.
I heard, and I just want to be corrected, that council had to agree to it too, and I thought that was new information. I hadn't heard.
Okay, I'll just reread it. So it says temporary pedestrian connectivity to and from the railway station is to be provided during the development as required by an appropriate pedestrian access study commissioned by the developer to the satisfaction of council. And the second point was the developer will consult, facilitate and manage the process between DTMR and the council for the pedestrian link.
Because I was of the opinion it was in the state yesterday.
I thought it was too.
That's news to me, the word council, if I can put it that way, because I'm sure it was state was put to us yesterday.
Through the chair, just to...
As we are in formal proceedings here, Jonathan, would you like to respond?
I was just going to make the comment that obviously crossing the road is one portion of that, but providing footpaths and connectivity to get to either side of that is also would be a council matter to be considered. So there are, you know, and usually in these situations where there is pedestrianisation across state roads, there is always some involvement of the local authority with the state. So.
I think the question, if I recall correctly, was about a pedestrian crossing on a state government road. I think this is a little bit broader than that. But Speaker 4. It was a question. Sorry, Councillor Mitchell.
Thank you, Madam Mayor. Yes, so we'll be supporting the amended proposal because I think it does give us the best outcome or the best chance of a good outcome if all that it took was emotion and hope, then you'd see me being as emotional and hopeful as some others. But I think we've got to stay on the application. I want to assure my community that I've heard all your concerns and they've really been taken into close consideration. I think people like Alb and John Derbyshire, the people I've spoken on the phone that have emailed me, I think the hours of conversation and advice that we've had amongst our councillors and officers. That said, I recognise the parking pressures in the area. I recognise the concerns of our Edgewater residents around privacy, the tree that we're all being careful of, and the pedestrian path. There are positives to this application and what we're hoping to achieve. 25% increase in parking. If we can get that through, that'd be a great result. Discussed RPAC. There are discussions around how we link that into our CBD. So that is underway. The master plan, I've been speaking with officers and it's got some great bones. And that needs to certainly underpin what we do moving forward. There will be construction jobs if this goes ahead. There is tourism accommodation in this development. There are positives. It's an imperfect misuse development, but it is a mixed-use development. It's an imperfect TOD, principles, I believe, but at least it starts that process. There are good things about this moving forward as well. And I just look forward to this adding to some urgency around the principles of our CBD master plan and our transport strategy. So while it's imperfect, I think the best way forward and the best community outcome will be on supporting this current amended proposal. Thanks.
Speaker against, Councillor Bishop.
Thank you very much, Madam Mayor. Can I ask, first of all, when the Cleveland Master Plan was created?
Which version?
Thank you. Thanks for asking that question. July 2010. Maybe it was amendment. I'm referring to a page here that just talks about growth of Cleveland Centre, which is page 16. And it just sort of identifies that in years 0 to 5, 5 to 10, and 10 to 15 specifically, that's when the creation of the transport-oriented design element was really critical. And I think we're now, this decision forces us to look as decision makers at how this particular part of land which is owned by the state is going to be developed. Our assessment of this application, of course, needs to be mindful of development assessment processes, but I think we need to make a decision as councillors in the interest of the future of this city. And we need to assess this application in relation to that. We need to acknowledge that in the first instance, the first principle that we must refer to is, and I thank John Derbyshire for having put forward the connecting SEQ 2031 document statement that says, while growth in car park needs to be constrained, policies that too quickly reduce the supply of car parking and increase its cost could strangle growth of these centres. So I think that's the starting, overarching framing point that we need to assess this in that context. Then when we move down to the Redlands issue, we need to acknowledge that as councillors, we have got a city that relies on those corridors into CBD for a lot of our residents to get up into the city. And by increasing and acknowledging that we are more than 15 kilometres from Brisbane CBD and commuters needing access, and I'll go on to acknowledge that in the SEQ 2031 connecting SEQ, it actually suggests that transport and land use planning should occur concurrently with development to be sequenced with transport infrastructure provision, management of car parking supply in regional activity centres and around high-frequency public transport corridors to supply more walking, cycling and use of public transport. This is a terminus. It's at the end of the line, and all of the suburbs south of Cleveland actually need... It's the closest point for them. So for us to constrain and to consider not including the footprint of a TOD,
with the maximum capacity for now and in future. We've got Toondah coming online. We've got Stratty in transition. They've got all the growth down south. The only and first access point they have is Cleveland's CBD, and that's the TOD that we're looking at now. So I think we as councillors, yes, of course, we've got to be aware of the development assessment, but we need to actually be aware of the needs of the future of this city, and particularly this CBD, which brings me to why I think the Cleveland CBD Master Plan is of particular significance. You're fidgeting there, councillor. I just want to... Councillor Baglari mentioned before that in terms of car parking, in specific relation to the Cleveland Station, which is 6.11 on page 63 of the Cleveland Master Plan, the proposed land use for this site is for commercial, for retail, for leisure, for conference facilities. It does mention residential apartment, which is quite different to this application. This is an application for residential with a small element of accommodation. And it also talks about proposed land use being parking and transport interchange. We as councillors need to acknowledge that there's a whole bus circuit that links all around the CBD, connecting to the south, and people arrive at this point expecting to have car parks to get to the city. We also need to think of every other car park and every other train stop before we get up to Manly, because we know that SEQ regional plan doesn't provide for any extended further upgrades beyond Manly. So how are we going to make sure people are more walkable and more connected? We're going to have to provide car parks. We've got to think differently to the way the Minister will be thinking, and I acknowledge that it was mentioned yesterday that the Minister will not be increasing funding for car parking around these areas. But we do need to specifically relate to these sorts of documents. I'm amazed that we are years down the track without having come back to this document to guide us specifically with formalising what we want as a TOD in this area, because if we had been, we would have acknowledged that the car parking, as mentioned on page 64 of this document, the car parking policy says provision of car parking within a structure to the rear of the development, and I have a photograph here that I've
Councilor,
sent to you
all.
Councillor,
I know you keep referring to that document, but
this is how we make
thank
decisions
you, thank you. While the chair,
as opposed to development
standing
assessment.
Orders, councillors, while the Chair speaks.
I'll stop.
You listen, thank you. So we have referred to the Master Plan and its weight on this application, and I appreciate that that's a document that you have in front of you, but you have been told, not only by the Acting General Manager, Organised Social Services, but Legal Counsel, of the weight that will be given when it's assessed by a P&E Court.
Thank you. I take that on board.
And our obligation to assess this under Sustainable Planning Act.
I understand that officers must assess it in that regard, but we as the
decision
makers...
We are also obliged
yes.
to work under those pieces of legislation.
Indeed. And if you suggest that these are irrelevant documents, I think that would be...
I wasn't suggesting that, Councillor.
And I'm suggesting that the relevance is what I'm referring to in relation to this particular matter.
Well, I'm asking you to move on and go back to the application, please. So you're speaking against it. I appreciate you've made your
Can point. I choose to disagree with that?
Councillor...
Because it's directly related, and I believe it's specifically on point.
And you've actually mentioned it, and now you want to add some new information.
Not new information. I want to allow councillors to be aware of what I'm aware of now, having looked at this document, and I wish that we'd been discussing
be really
this
to
in
have,
relation
have
to this.
Have some understanding of the standing
we
orders.
We haven't.
Thank you. Thank you.
Are you suggesting that I need to stop speaking?
I'm suggesting you need to refer to other elements of which what you disagree.
That I can't refer to the Master Plan? Are you suggesting that?
Councillor, the time's ticking.
I know, and I'm asking for you to allow me to proceed.
Councillor.
Ma'am, can I ask if that's a current master plan? I believe it's been revised since then.
I think it's also been adopted into our planning scheme, if I'm correct. Can our officers respond to that, please?
Thank you, Madam Mayor, and through the Chair. Elements of the Cleveland Master Plan have been adopted into the current planning scheme. I believe that was in 2013 to 2014, and those elements have been carried across into the draft city plan.
Can I refer to this document? Can I continue to?
Although I will be proceeding with standing orders, because with the 5 minutes, councillors, because you've well and truly gone to that point.
Would you like me to put all this information and make it available to my fellows?
Councillor, I just expect you to be treated
after the meeting, after the decision.
Councillor, I expect you to operate in the same under the
Can
same standing order. Thank you, as under the same standing orders and principles as everyone else in this chamber. That's all I'm asking. Thank you.
The parking provided for both train station users, as well as enough provision to support the commercial premises, and also for people attending other business and leisure activities within the complex. There's a photograph, a drawing here that suggests multiple car parking on this specific site for the future provision of parking, so people can actually functionally access Cleveland CBD, which is a vital and still the most vibrant hub for the future of this city. Surely if we are having discussions with the state government using SEQ, connecting SEQ 2031, using their framework, we would not want to constrain this by approving this application. I'm suggesting that we should refuse it. We should come back with a master plan for the entire parking for Redland City, specifically relating to the Cleveland CBD. I would encourage councillors to refer themselves to this document for us to review this and make sure we get this right. Let's please continue discussions with the state government and with any proposed developer, and let's go back and look at the things that are requested for this specific site, and let's get them right, because if we don't get them right, we will miss the biggest opportunity. And if we've got someone who wants to build there, let's ask them to get it right for the sake of our city. Thank you. Refuse this, please.
Speaker 4, councillors. Councillor Totti. I don't think it's a Speaker 4. Yeah. Speaker 4.
Thank you, Madam Mayor. It's disappointing that when this was originally flagged and people from the state came down and said in principle, you know, would we be in agreement with a proposal being put forward? And we did. We agreed that in principle we supported having residential there if that was, advisable. I think as the process has moved on, we've been disappointed with the lack of generosity in the proposal. That, to my mind, taking a public asset and essentially privatising it needs to provide a balance for increased livability and increased services for the community. It has to be a ledger which provides a greater increase for the local community. And I'm not seeing an increase for the local community in this application response, but by the same token, we have to understand that we have to work within the Sustainable Planning Act, and a simple refusal will take us out of the loop. And as our current documents provide the level of car parking that is code accessible, that is in the report, if we simply refuse it, then there's a high probability that it will simply be approved and we will have no further point of argument. So the proposal by Councillor Hughes to basically put in some points in a preliminary approval, which more or less asks the applicants to be more generous and more considerate, whilst they may not strictly have to do that in law, is our best shot at getting an improved outcome for the community. It is unfortunate that the state has not negotiated a better deal for our residents, is my view. I note in the report, for example, at point 4, vegetation clearing, that in response to the point 2, the tree, the development on lot 1 is not part of the application. The state can remove the trees at any time on their land. In general, tree removal must be considered on merit, in context, and having regard to other relevant matters such as safety and most efficient use of land, addressed in the impact on trees section of the report. So we can try. We can put dot point 2 in and we can put that out there for the community to be aware of, but essentially we are fairly powerless in this. If the state chooses to remove a tree on state land, they can do so. But I will support this because, unfortunately, it is the best possible outcome for this application. I would have liked, going back to the point where they came forward and said, would we in principle support an application coming forward for residential on this site, I would have liked to have seen a more generous application. I would have expected that we would have seen an extra layer on that building that would be able to be dedicated to commuter car parking. That's out of our remit, but that's what I think our community would have expected. So I don't believe this is a very generous application, but at this point in time, I'll support Councillor Hughes's motion. Thank you.
Speaker against? Councillor Hewlett.
Thank you, Madam Mayor. Whether it's a road, whether it's a hospital, whether it's a police station, whether it's a car park, the state continues to hang the lack of infrastructure in this city around our necks and drag us down. It's a really, in my opinion, this is a really missed opportunity. That could have been a much better development which would balance community with the development's requirements for parking. We can't talk about the assessment of the QR area, but we can certainly talk about the impact. I've had dozens of my residents that go there to drive their car there to go to the city each day complain about this impending development and the lack of parking. And what concerns...
So Councillor, it was a good try.
Well,
we understand. We all agree. Well, we all agree that there's not enough commuter car parking in the city, and whether this is the right place or not. But we are talking about the application, unfortunately.
Well, I completely agree with the comments made by John Derbyshire this morning, and I think this will stand up in court. I really have grave concerns about the parking at RPAC. If you try to cross that road, what solution are they going to offer for that? It's one of the worst roundabouts I've ever seen in this city. It's dangerous. So apart from that first person that gets killed over there, it's going to be a public uproar. I just can't support it. It's such a missed opportunity for something great down there. I have no problem with residential. I think that's where you want development over train stations. But, geez, without parking, can't support it.
Well, I think that, to be clear, there is parking.
That's why I have valets.
And we've asked, thank you, and that's why we're asking for a 25% increase in that parking through this preliminary approval. Let's not lose sight of that. Well, let me make this very clear, and I'll get the officers probably to make this clear. We are not debating the commuter car park here for QR. It would be nice if we were. It would be probably fruitless. We are not, thank you, Council, we are not debating that. It was made clear in the very first point of order. They're providing an extra 17 car parks, I believe, through to the north with QR as a result of the arrangement. We are not debating that. We have no control. That will not be debated in the P&E court. Okay, so thank you. I just... being really clear, we are asking for 25% more parking for that particular application. Is everyone clear on that?
But just responding to you, Madam Mayor, I was talking about as we put open space constraints on development, we should also put community parking in our CBD on development as well.
That's great.
So I'm not talking about the railway parking. In my opinion, that development should be made to provide community parking.
As has been said, councillors, and I've been here a while now, you can all sit here on your soapbox and talk about how the policy is not working for your community. Your only way, your only tool, is as councillors to change the policy, not to talk about it. Well, it's great you're all nodding now, but this is a debate you have to have and have embedded in legislation before you can actually have those teeth in a P&E court. That is not, let me repeat, that is not a statutory document, councillor. It's not a statutory document. Okay. So I appreciate the frustration. We are not debating the commuter car park here today. Okay. So we have any other speakers? Questions? I've had a couple of people. Councillor Golay had his hand up at questions first, I think.
Thank you, Madam Mayor. With respect, I just have a couple of questions. In a document we received from Councillor Hughes this morning, it says that this is in conflict, the South East Queensland regional plan to our planning scheme, but it's saying our planning scheme then becomes the precedent set in court. Is the South East regional plan the higher document, and are we in conflict with the South East regional Queensland plan as registered here? That's my first question.
Thank you, Madam Mayor. Thank you for the question. The Council's planning scheme is the statutory document that development is assessed against, except to any inconsistency with the regional plan. Council's planning scheme has been accepted as reflecting the regional plan, and we know through the state interest review of the draft planning scheme, draft city plan, which carries forward those policy settings, that the draft city plan is consistent with the SEQ regional plan. So that's been signed off on. Was there another part to your question on that?
Yes, thanks for that. It says the it doesn't comply with the principles and policies of the South East Queensland Regional Plan, particularly desired regional outcome 8. The development is inconsistent with the types of multi-use development that will support the creation of a properly functioning activity centre and an efficient transit system. So that's why I'm questioning, are we out of kilter here? And I suppose it would lead into the next component of my question, which reflects upon the Cleveland Centre Master Plan. How much of that document have we actually incorporated into our new proposed plan to go to state government?
We've carried over what's already in there.
So nothing new has been added?
No, and if I know that there's been discussions about us reviewing our master plans without sort of trying to...
Mm-hmm.
If you recall those workshops we've had, councillors. Okay. Some of you, if I recall, actually wanted looking at even greater heights
yes.
and like to have that reviewed.
Yes. I for one... I know we're under delegation need to look at this approach from a whole of city perspective, and I suppose Division 3 has been affected more so by development. So I, for one, actually applaud an initiative to go up and have buildings in the CBD that can serve as professional people and give transport. I, like everyone else, have the issues with the parking. I applaud the 25%. Increase. I think that's a good move. And I think that to support Councillor Hughes and what Councillor Tolte said too, we are in a position now where we can put this forward or we could refuse it outright and we will take the initiative away from Council. We'll end up in a situation where the state will step in and pretty much have all the power. We can't crystal ball what a magistrate or a judge will rule upon in the P&E court. I just think, though, it really comes back down to the bare basics, which is how do we get the best design outcomes for our city? Is there reviews that we need to do prior to putting a stamp on this or pushing it forward? Does it meet our requirements under our new proposed city plan? And are we possibly getting the best outcomes for the community? And I think that's what everyone's trying to drive at. So I guess I'm trying to work out Madam Mayor, it's really the where does the hierarchy of the documents come in?
I'll get officers to explain that again. I think it's
how much have we taken from the Cleveland Master Plan? It's
the relevant documents for assessment today are the planning scheme. The planning scheme is signed off by the state government, who obviously is responsible for the South East Regional Plan, and they line up. That they automatically line up when those changes happen. So it's not a statutory document. We took elements of that. I can't tell you any other way, councillor. It's not a statutory document. I think I've said it four or five times. It's not a statutory document. It's a guide. It is a guideline that helps us make planning decisions and influences our draft plan. But it's not a statutory document. And that's a frustration we have, that's frustration I have, because until you guys put this into policy, into legislation that's recognised by the state, it gives us no teeth at this point in time. So I've got another question from Councillor Gleeson. And please make it quick, because you've already had...
Thanks, Madam Mayor. I've got a question and a comment, if I may. First, I will go quick, through you to the officers. Can I just confirm, the Northern Car Park has existing 146 car parks, and the developer's going to build 78 car parks at RPAC. So there's a deficiency of 68 there in the interim?
That's correct, yes.
Okay. So at the moment we're running, RPAC are running daytime programs, particularly during school hours. We're running things like citizenship ceremonies with a 5:30 start time, and that car park is going to be chockers. And certainly tonight there'll probably be over 100 cars there, I would be pretty confident in saying. Tomorrow morning. Monday to Friday, there'll be no events there. You might as well write off events till 7 o'clock at night, any daytime events. And I'm assuming it'll be a year or two before stage one is complete and the car park has been replaced. I have a problem with that, and it will have detrimental impacts on RPAC. Secondly, my comment is this. Look, there's a number of us in the room here that have been targeted by certain elements in the community over the last few years with comments of, you know, development at all costs, et cetera, et cetera. I know we've put through some pretty tough decisions and we've had to approve some developments that most of us didn't really like. In most cases, we absolutely hated it, but we had no option because it was the law. And these were residential issues that we've had to face, and we've copped some backlash, probably mostly unfairly from the community because the results were really out of our hands. And for the most case, I refuse to waste ratepayers' money in court fighting a development that we can't
really
lose.
What's this got to do with the application?
What's your point?
I'm coming to that.
Thank you, Councillor. Can you please wrap up and stick to the item in front of you?
Thank you. For the most part, I refuse to waste ratepayers' money going to court, but I think this is a pretty significant development, and I think when this reaches the front page of next week's paper, the community are going to say this was worth fighting. And I really don't think that... I think that will be an expectation. I really don't think the amended motion has legal grounds. I don't think a refusal has legal grounds, but I think at some point the community are going to say, listen, guys, this is significant enough to warrant sending a message to the state government.
Any other comments, councillors? Just a couple of things. Obviously, there are a couple of comments that have been made this morning, and I guess we are very focused on providing opportunities for our community to leave the city to work. And at the same time, we're trying to promote the CBD to be vibrant and to have opportunities for investment. And that comes at trying to find that balance with these sorts of applications. I mean, certainly from my point of view, I'd like to see the city be a place that people get on the train and get off the train that doesn't have those issues. So at some point we have to make decisions where we have a population that will support the businesses that will decide to invest here in the future. That's going to take people. We have constraints, we have the bay, we have existing urban areas and all those sorts of things, and we're going to have to make it fit. If we are serious about a CBD that's going to attract people here, not have them drive from the south of the city to find a way out. This is just crunch time. You know, we've been talking about this. This has been a topic of debate for a long time. This is the crunch time, which is why the transport strategy and doing things differently and disrupting the way we have traditionally put forward how we deal with commuting and transport and places like this. It's not easy. We probably will cop a slap. I pretty much guarantee that for making a hard decision. Today we've tried to find that compromise, and I congratulate Councillor Hughes because at least this requires it coming back to us and us having some handle on the outcome. And you can spend as much money as you like and you might think it's a great investment. For me, it's about making sure that we deliver what the community expects, not just to have the fight. And I'm afraid that you probably, in my view, from what we've been told, and I know there's different views in the community in here, let's face it, this is state government land, it's QR at least, they may join in an appeal. This is a state government policy position about TODs. I don't hold a lot of hope in taking them on in a P&E court. I do hold a lot of hope in the fact that we can keep our community engaged through a development permit that comes through this preliminary application. I think we're misleading our community if we think that, you know, just by a right out no is going to deliver the result that they want. And that's where today, and I was grateful that we had an opportunity to find this compromise that allows us to have a handle on it. But let's not lose sight of the fact that we want people to come to the CBD of Cleveland. We're not talking about getting them out of the city. We need to do things differently, whether it's through innovation, whether it's through transport. Until you make these tough decisions, that's not going to happen because people aren't going to be keen to invest in a place where they don't have the certainty that they're going to have people to support their businesses or the people to actually deliver those services. So it's big picture. It's not necessarily just this application, but this is the crunch time. We've got a state government that's not even recognising for what it's worth, SEQ 2031, that we need a duplication of rail. And I encourage people in the community who are upset about the fact we have no transport to get on their computers, if you've got connectivity, for goodness sake, in the 21st century, and let the state government know that we expect better connectivity via rail, via bus, via internet, all of the above. And we expect that we can accommodate that as we have these growing pains, because these are growing pains, the region is growing. So, you know, and the more we say no to these sorts of things, the less likely the government's actually going to acknowledge that we need that duplication of rail or we need that eastern busway, because they will be relying on the growth of other regions in southeast Queensland to provide that growth and hence put their hand up for the infrastructure. So, look, like I said, it's not an easy decision today. I think the preliminary approval gives the community at least a handle on where it goes forward from here. And, you know, the rest of it's really in the hands of, potentially in the hands of the court either way, because this probably will be challenged regardless. That would be my view. So I'm going to ask Councillor Hughes now to sum up, if I may. Councillor Hughes, we've had a long debate. Thank you. Sorry, Paul, I'm trying to get to the end of this debate. Councillor Bishop. Councillor Hughes.
Thanks very much. I just would like to point out that, just summing up a couple of things, the car parking numbers that were put in this document, this report from Council, relied on the transit-oriented development guide. And we've been talking about our guides and our plans. I think we need to kick back and say also, and just take note that the state is a guide. And when you open it and you go to the forward from Minister Hinchcliffe, just very, very, very briefly, it says, I hope you'll find this transit-orientated development guide a useful resource. It's not their Bible either. This is a resource. I just want to remind people of that. We've got a briefing note.
Your Councillor Hughes, that you actually need, you can't add new information. It's a sum up. This is standing orders.
Yeah, no new information.
I actually asked that before. I wanted to sum up before when I opened with I got interrupted to come back to me. So I've sat here very quietly waiting. That's actually what I was asking previously, and I got shot down for now.
Well, I think
so,
you mentioned summing. You wanted to sum
up. Yeah,
but
I wanted to sum up my opening statement. So my bad on that. Also, decisions should be made on a reasonable basis, and we need to be looking at alternate ways to stimulate business activity, such as improving car parking. We've got that in our own briefing note. I understand that I can't move a second motion, and if this motion does not get through, that I have supplied to all councillors the potential grounds for refusal.
Councillor,
and if someone else would like
to
move
you've
that,
mentioned
that's
that, and it's
fine.
Actually outside of standing orders. You need
okay.
to be coming up.
There's 13 issues to debate on that document. So ultimately, we all agree we are not happy with this development application. I seek again legal counsel that my concern is if we just end up in court on these two points, we could go backwards. But if we can get these two points through to with the developer and come to an outcome, that will help our community. That's our dilemma here. We go with these two and try, or we take it to court and see how we go. And many people here are saying that they feel that we probably wouldn't win that either. Thanks, Andrew. Can you just sum
that
up?
Well, I think
for
that's a sum up now. Sorry, Councillor. Yeah. I'll allow Andrew to respond.
I'm actually not sure if that was a question, though. That's,
Just to reiterate again, we take these two points back to the developer, and then it's up to them to come back to us with a new application, and we assess that, or they take it.
No.
No.
We'll
or then they take it, or they take us to court.
Yeah, they come back with a development, asking for a development permit. Okay. Yes. So I think that's what you mean. Yeah. Sorry, Matt.
That's true. But it needs to satisfy those preliminary conditions provided before it comes back to council. And even if it goes to court, it needs to satisfy those preliminary conditions if it goes to court.
We're going around the room. I think most people have made their mind up through this debate, which we've had a number of times now. Thank you, Councillor Hughes. That was
Madam Mayor, could I just ask a technical question? I know it's out of order, but
I'm a little bit concerned with dot point one, where it refers to the parking in planning scheme V7.1. I'd like an officer just to confirm that that's not a self-defeating dot point, where that section of the planning scheme doesn't simply refer to the other documents of council, which will then refer them back to what's already been assessed in code, so that if we do this, they're not going to just come back and say, well, yeah, we refer to your point, your dot point of V71, which says in this section you go to this other policy, which then says you have this much parking, which is exactly what they've already done, which is already within the code.
I think Chris assisted in the creation of this.
Yeah, so this is drafted differently to how I suggested. So in this drafting would do exactly that. In Council's resolution of the incentives package, it identified that the one space per unit satisfies the specific outcomes of the Redlands planning scheme. That's resolved by Council. The suggested wording was to refer to the probable solution in the planning scheme, which is the 1.25 square metres.
No. So, Councillor, I'm going to suggest that you ask that we provide further clarity to point. This is what I asked up front, councillors. This is why. Anyway, we had councillors. If we can ask, I'll ask through Andrew Ross, who's acting in that position. We're just going to provide some further clarity to point one, which will probably outline exactly what was originally proposed, which is in line with that anyway.
Madam
Mayor, I'll seek an amendment.
Should I propose a suspension of the meeting for a 10-minute break?
I think we have. We actually have the original. Andrew?
The standing. Through Madam Chair, certainly the standing orders allow for the amendment of an amended motion to allow for minor changes to words to ensure that its intent is better understood without changing the meaning of the amended motion. So you can deal with that clarification.
So if I could just have the officers suggested. Thanks, Chris. And while that's happening, I just wanted to make sure that addresses the issue that Councillor Tolte has raised in regards to referring it to further policy documents that aren't in keeping with what we're trying to achieve.
Councillors, I would just like to point out dot points 3 and 4, we will delete 1 and 2, so we're not going to play with the formatting right at this moment. We will fix that up in a sec. 3 and 4 is the advice that Chris Byers sent out to all councillors yesterday afternoon, which provides that clarity and that certainty on those 2 points that Councillor Hughes has put up. Yes.
Comfortable with that? You've just got the advice note? I'll have the officer reiterate that doesn't put us in a sort of a groundhog day where we're going backward and forward with the same policies that have delivered this outcome.
So by including that advice note, it gives guidance to the officers and to the applicant that what we're looking for is a 1.25 parking spaces per unit rate, which is the probable solution in the planning scheme, as opposed to the one space per parking.
So a 25% increase on parking, correct? Just let me get that nod from officers and everyone around. Councillor Hughes, are you happy with that advice note to be added? And the seconder was Julie, I think, Councillor Tolte. Were you the second? Oh, no, Councillor Mitchell, you're happy with that? I don't think it requires an amendment according to the advice we've been given by Andrew Ross. It's just providing that clarity. Okay. With that, councillors, I'll put the motion. those in favour? Yep. Okay, that's carried, councillors. So those in favour are Councillor Mitchell, Councillor Golay, Councillor Edwards, Councillor Elliott, Councillor Hughes, Councillor Tolte, Councillor Williams. Those against, Councillor Boglari, Councillor Hewlett, and Councillor Gleeson and Councillor Bishop. Thank you, councillors. Thank you. On to the next item, councillors. Wherever I am, that right. So We'll reserve the little comments for later, councillors, if you may. On to 11.3.1 is the... I think I've got Councillor Boglari moving that one. Or presenting that, Councillor Boglari.
I'd just like to move agenda item 11.3.1, Redlands Sporting Club and Redlands Cricket Club Incorporated lease renewal and new lease, please, as per officer's recommendation.
Move, Councillor Boglari. Seconded, Councillor Edwards. Would you like to speak to it, Councillor Boglari?
No, I think it's all in the report. They're both great clubs. They've invested quite a lot in their infrastructure in that area, and this is just to give them certainty that, you know, they're going to be able to continue using that area. That's all. It's
any other questions, councillors? Speaker against? Question?
It's actually just a comment. It's acknowledging that a 30-year lease is a lengthy term, and obviously that'll straddle several committees, one would think, and just acknowledging that when there's infrastructure and leases associated, it's just important that Redlands residents continue to collaborate with one another. There are many members of the community, and while these, particularly the Redlands Cricket Incorporated, will have ownership of this building, it's always good that I know that they do include other groups. I think it's just important that they just continue that collaboration and communication and allowing other people to use infrastructure and make sure that there are harmonious pathways going forward to ensure that happens. Thank you.
Thanks, Councillor Bishop. Any other questions, comments? If there are none, I'll put the motion. Those in favour? Those against? The motion is carried unanimously. Item 11.3.2, Councillor Hewlett, I believe you're presenting that.
Thank you, Madam Mayor. I'd like to move 11.3.2, Wilson Esplanade Victoria Point Foreshore Protection.
Councillor Hewlett, seconded by Councillor Bishop. Would you like to speak to it, Councillor Hewlett?
I would, thank you. Madam Chair, sorry. Had a bit of a tongue twist there for a moment. I'd just like to thank the officers for the community consultation they did on this foreshore walk. It was planned to be a rock wall. Prior to that happening, I did actually ask the officers to look at alternative options. So we went out in further public community consultation, and the community came back with they wanted to keep the sand beach aesthetic of that Wilson's Esplanade area. Victoria Point's got some of the most accessible beachfront in the southern Redlands, including Coochie Mudlow Island. You've got Thompson's Beach, that Wilson, I can guarantee you tomorrow that area is going to be flooded with families, particularly little toddlers that like to just run straight off the grass onto the sand. You can't embrace a rock wall, unfortunately. There are alternative options. Although there is an operational cost here, I think a rock wall would have also increased operational cost because rock walls increase the energy of water and they push sand away and you end up with a mud flat and mangroves. So this bit of sandy beach at Wilson's Esplanade is really embraced and there's ownership of the community of this area, and I would appreciate your support on the officer's recommendation. Thank you.
Speaker against, Councillor Gleeson.
Poorly.
Thanks, Madam Mayor. I'm not going to support the officer's recommendation. I believe that this is just a short-term fix that's going to increase our operational costs going forward. I note the seawall is in the Capital Works program. It's funded. It's a much longer lasting project rather than going down the beach nourishment process. And also, I note under the risks under beach nourishment, which says frequency of re-nourishment has been estimated, but it's dependent on actual conditions encountered over time. And we could have a cyclone or the effects of a cyclone every 12 months and have to re-spend that $54,000 because it's only an estimate. We can't foresee into the future. I think the seawall gives us more certainty and gives ratepayers more certainty over where their money's being spent. I won't be supporting officer recommendation, Madam Mayor.
Have a speaker for Councillor Bishop.
Oh, thank you, Madam Mayor, and just acknowledging the work that officers have been doing in this space. It is an important space. We love our foreshores, and those councillors who do have foreshores know how much community attitudes have. You know, they vary enormously. Some people are very pro rock wall. Others want to have a much more lighter footprint. I think the balance that's been struck here is important and appropriate. particularly noting that there will be ongoing assessment along the way, and I think as more information comes to light, I'd just like to acknowledge that community consultation, while it's a bit hairy and sometimes a bit audacious, it actually does get the sort of engagement and interest from the community, and I think the option of replenishment is not... it's not cost prohibitive. It means that we can take a softly approach, and there are other alternatives going forward. And rock wall is an extreme option. And while in certain instances it's very appropriate, I think that the way they've gone here is tremendous, and great to see the councillor supporting that community consultation and officers benefiting from that. And I think it tells us very clearly that's what the community wants. And I think with the ongoing assessment, I've every faith that this is the right way to go.
Speaker against? A couple of people that want to make some comments. I noticed lots of hands go up, so I'll go around the room. Councillor Tolte.
Oh, thank you, Madam Mayor. Yes, I'll be supporting the officer's recommendation in this regard. Having grown up in the Redlands, there are many beaches that I went to as a child, and I grew up in Victoria Point at Point Halloran, so Wilson's Esplanade and Point Halloran Beach I spent a lot of time at when I was a child. And as rock walls have gone in over time, they've just repeatedly disappointed me with the shape and the batter of those big black granite rocks. It just takes away all the enjoyment and access of the beach. So I think, you know, they have their place in places where people aren't actually going to be attempting to access the bay, but in places where people are actually going to be using foreshore parks and trying to access the water, they're not successful. They're very unpleasant. If in time replenishment becomes too costly or has to be reviewed, then I would suggest that we can then look at different types of engineering and design, but not a granite rock dump battered wall. So, yes, I would encourage people to at least give this the opportunity at a point where we've got a foreshore park.
Councillor Edwards.
Oh, thank you. I think we've all had, on many occasions, our residents voice concerns that they feel that other areas on the foreshore, other councils, are some way more receptive to providing an ideal interface for the community and the water and the foreshore. And there's lots of councils who have embraced the vision and the commitment to rejuvenate their foreshores through sand replacement as a matter of course, because that's what the community expects and desires, and particularly in tourist areas such as the Gold Coast and further down the coast, north and south. Now, I'd like to see our foreshore parks and our water access improve across the whole of Redlands, and I think we need to get our mindset, what's our vision for the future? What do we want to see? Mm-hmm. Do you take it piece by piece and put rock walls there or whatever it is, and you diminish that interaction? Or do you say, no, we want to keep this natural type of environment, even if there is a cost, an ongoing cost, because we feel there is benefit in the future, and it will also help our tourism strategy. So I acknowledge there's costs, and that's the thing in council, you're always waiting, there's a cost, an ongoing thing, how to keep that cost down for the ratepayers. But in my vision, I see it's trying to improve our water access. And if it takes renourishment of beaches around the city for the next 20, 30, 40, 50 years, I think that's one of the costs that we should be paying for, because I think the community want it.
Councillor Gollo? Hilda, will you turn off your microphone, please?
Thanks, Madam Chair. Yeah, straight to the point. We talk about economic development, bringing tourism to our coastline and letting them enjoy the bay for what it is, with a few coffee shops. It's a winner all round. Thank you.
Councillor Mitchell?
Yes, comment. Certainly be supporting it. I think moving forward, it needs to be a side-by-side assessment with our open space strategy. I think our selected beaches can be treated the same way as our parks. What's the level of service and what's the lifetime cost? The right beach, right place, right time. More often than not, sand's better than rock, but... as long as it's targeted, I think, yeah, bring it on. But it needs regular assessment, and I think we can accommodate that in our open space strategy. Thanks.
I ditto most of the other comments about tourism, and also we are a wonderful city of islands and foreshore, so we have to protect it because that is our unique and our uniqueness and our branding is our wonderful foreshore. I have the same issues, and part of Wellington Point actually has a rock wall, and not a month would go by where I don't get an email about can officers go down there and do work on that rock wall, because children carry the rocks out and then everyone kicks their toes on the rock. So there's constant maintenance with the rock wall as well, and it's one of the biggest number of emails I'll probably get is that rock wall. So, you know, to say a rock wall doesn't have maintenance costs, it does. And whether it equals the sand replenishment, I don't know. But I know at Wellington Point we have massive erosion problems, just like Councillor Hewlett does, and we've discussed this. And people want the beach. You know, that's what they love about Redlands. The grandparents taking the kids down, the family outings. That is what we are about. So totally support Councillor Hewlett on this one.
What's that?
Do you want to speak, Councillor Elliott? I'm right for you to sum up. Thank you.
Talking, my apologies. Just in response to Councillor Gleeson's comment, I actually did speak to officers about a alternative plan. They think this has sufficed for Wilson's Esplanade at this present time, and they will monitor, and if necessary, they will reintroduce into the CAPEX a natural treatment, which is about $100,000 less, and uses a product called geofabric armour bags, where you can actually bury them in the sand. They're sand-coloured, they're very vandal-proof, and you can actually cover them with sand, and they provide very similar, if not the same, protection. So by geez, by crikeys, by jingos, no one's taking my beach away, my friend.
Okay, Council.
But no,
just a reminder, you're in formal proceedings here in Council. Thank you.
Councillors. I'd just like to move the officer's recommendation, please.
Thank you. With that, Councillors, I'll put the motion. Those in favour? Those against? The motion is carried, and it's carried with the exception of Councillor Gleeson, who voted in the negative. Councillors, the next item, there are no mayoral minutes. We have no urgent business, so I'm moving to the closed session. Councillors, I did send I had the CEO send a note around. There was a question about confidentiality. Are you happy to move it without going into closed session?
Yeah, my question's been answered.
Yeah?
Yeah, if I may.
If it's an assessment, wouldn't it be in the public domain anyway?
That's what I'm saying. Yeah. It's part of this document, and all I'm suggesting is as those things are in the public domain, it should be released in the public domain.
Yep, sure.
So, Council, this is an interesting one. And I absolutely agree with you in that sort of sense that what we're saying here is that the main request is that these aren't made public because they're unaudited statements. And so our chairman in particular and the independent directors who have an extensive experience in litigation and KPMG, Phil Hennessy, if you know Phil, has expressed that. This came out originally from a QAO audit which recommended we put up our quarterly statements. So we agree, and we did talk to QAO, and I know Deb was in on those discussions, probably on the outside, that because they're unaudited, there is a risk of putting these up as a subsidiary company in those sort of things. But the other side of it, which I said also in that note to put on the public record, is there are some projects which are commercially sensitive, but they're also in there which ones we should be releasing. So RIC does that from time to time, as you know. They do the media releases, they do the applications. So as a director, I will pass back to the ones to do that. And as you know, councillors, you get access to these. If you have that request, either through myself or through Peter Kelly, our CEO of RIC, I'm happy for you to request that some information be made public. That'll be assessed as a normal process to do that. But it's just... it's that conjecture in this one of those couple of things is why I still recommend that we remain it in confidential. And then our annual reports are all, when they're audited, are put on the web, and there is extensive information on RIC and what they're doing on their website.
Yeah. Thanks very much, Bill. Through you, Mayor. I agree with that totally. It's just as things mature, we should put them out there and away we go. Something like this is a project that's
and
on its way and XY.
Different
it's a
ways
good
of,
news story for the public, isn't it?
There's different ways of doing that, Councillor. I think, you know, it could be just from a media perspective rather than just a full report.
We don't have, you know, 14 pages of project we're doing.
Oh, someone's left some car keys behind. Okay. Sorry, Murray. Sure. So we don't need to go into confidential. If I can move and second for the report to be noted. Moved, Councillor Elliott, second to Councillor Boglari. Those in favour? Those against? The motion is carried unanimously. Thank you, councillors. I'll conclude the meeting at 12:50. Thank you for your participation.